23rd Committee on Rules. Representative Nelson, you're here on HCR 13 or HJM 7?
Five of them?
Yes,
it'll just take me one.
Come on up.
I'll make it very direct.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Which one are you going to do first?
State Representative Donna Nelson, District 24. And I don't know if you have any order, but I'll just start with House Concurrent Resolution 13.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on HCR 13. Fire away.
Okay, I just need to tell you that this is a very important bill in my district. This commemorates the 125th anniversary of Dayton. And for those of you who have eaten at the Joel Palmer House,
I was thinking of exactly that very location.
I don't have to say anymore because Dayton has such a historic background, and that's part of it. The Palmer, filing his claim. And I do want to mention this. You may not know your committee, your wonderful committee, and your wonderful administrators, that in 1987, Dayton was the first city in Oregon to be designated as a National Historic Resource, because of the numerous homes and buildings of historic interest within its boundaries. So a little town with only 2,000 people, but yet in our state it was number one, and I guess it will always be, as a national historic resource. So you can tell why this is very important. And we'll appreciate so much your passing this resolution. We've already celebrated here.
So we missed the celebration. You're asking us to pass a resolution, and you aren't even inviting us to the party?
No, I'm going to invite you to the real party, big deal.
All right.
Okay? But I do appreciate all the people at Dayton. They remind me of my hometown in Texas, and I love it, and they're wonderful. Please pass that bill. It's important to them.
All right. We're going to close the public hearing on HCR 13. HJM 7.
Thank you very much. Chair Brown and distinguished members of this committee and great administrators, I'd just like to read the letter from our mayor on this issue. This is a horrible situation where the Bureau of Land Management has failed to meet their obligations from damage they themselves caused, and in a little community of Carlton. So basically, this letter is from Kathy J. Oriott, the mayor, and she says, she wishes to thank me for bringing forth this joint memorial, House Joint Memorial 7, on behalf of the City of Carlton. This is a community of 1,560 residents, and here's what happened. During the winter of 1998 to 99, Carlton suffered a huge landslide from the Bureau of Land Management property into Carlton's raw water reservoir located west of Carlton on Panther Creek. How would you like to be a community that had no water? That's exactly what happened to these people. For weeks and months, they had to just buy bottled water after the Bureau of Land Management did not take care of its responsibility here. The Bureau estimated the size of the landslide to be 170 feet wide, and I'm sure Senator Farioli could give me what that's equal to, about five times this room, I think, by 250 feet long and up to 20 feet deep. That was the landslide. The National Guard, bless their hearts, brought potable water to the city, finally, for the residents to drink. Approximately one half of our storage capacity for water in Carlton has been lost due to this landslide. The good Congressman Wu worked on this for a little bit, but something has gone astray in Washington, maybe because they've not gotten a House joint resolution that says 90 of us think this is a rotten way to treat the citizens in our state.
That's the only thing, Representative Nelson, that takes us to fix Washington. We should have done it a long time ago.
I agree, good chair. But FEMA offered, can you believe this, $19,000, FEMA, for repair it requires $2 to $4.5 million to properly repair the damage done and create some mechanism to prevent future slides from fouling Carlton's water supply. And since the slide, the citizens of Carlton have invested $2.5 million in upgrades and additions to the water treatment plant, allowing them to treat water with that has the increased turbidity. So this joint memorial that will urge Congress to appropriate funding necessary to dredge this reservoir is very important. Please pass this measure.
Thank you. Okay, close the public hearing on HJM 7. Next one you're up on
House is Concurrent Resolution 17.
Okay, we'll do that one. House Concurrent Resolution 17.
Thank you, good committee. This is very important to me. Having lunch in the legislators' cafeteria, I asked our clerk of the House, Ramona Kennedy, you know, had her father ever been honored, having been the Speaker of the House? Mm-hmm. I mean, so many tours of duty here in Salem, and never had he been recognized. So that's what House Concurrent Resolution 17 does, honors Richard Iman for his legislative leadership and lifelong public service. And thank goodness for good Senator Terry Beyer. She had an emergency bill left over, so she was gracious to do this, and this is a wonderful event we had, and the family is most appreciative. So we already celebrated on the House, but we just need y'all to sign on with us.
Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on HCR 17 and open a public hearing on HJR 25.
HJR
Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much. This is very important to me. I sponsored the bill to have all of our individuals who qualify for the Staley Agreement to have them fully funded. And I'm in shock that we have thousands of developmentally disabled who are not receiving brokerage help they need with which to further their lives in a positive way. Since then, as that bill has not yet passed through the House, I was asked if that bill could be amended for us at least to get to use the reserve. There's a huge reserve. These people need help with their disabilities. So this is just a different type of way to go about it. If y'all wanted to amend this bill and put in the issue that we should be able to use that reserve money now to help these needy people who can be very successful in life if we just give them a helping hand, if y'all decide to do that, well, that would be wonderful. Thank you very much. I appreciate your support of House Bill 2050. Or HJR 25, sorry.
Great. Okay, any questions for Representative Nelson? Thank you very much. And so I'm assuming the last bill you're here to testify on is House Bill 2050.
Yes, thank you.
All right, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2050.
Thank you very much. As most know, I have most recently over this session been involved in comprehending the large, massive battle we have in this state, not only against drugs, but against sex abuse. To give you an example of why this is so important, in one instance, in my county where I have 365 perverts or predators or abusers, however you choose to identify these individuals who are rarely healed of this problem they have, a little girl who was threatened that she would be skinned, that means her skin removed, should she report the constant sexual attacks that she had to suffer. An only child of a prominent, nice family, reported through a church. The evidence was then gathered, and this individual went to prison. However, as he left the sentencing, he threatened this little girl that he would be there and be back. This is just one example I have in my community, and now is being protected by police actions, but it is certainly in the best interest of this victim to have the right to ask that he not live around the corner in a house on the same block. This is a horrendous situation. So I think this is a very important bill, and 3 miles, in my opinion, is not far enough away when the individual has to run into their abuser on a regular basis. So I support this measure, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any questions for Representative Nelson?
And thank you for all you're doing for all of us.
Thank you.
We're grateful.
All right. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2050. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3090. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Representative Thatcher, Representative Crummell, why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, House Bill 3090A prohibits ballot drop sites established by someone other than an election official from receiving ballots.
Thank you. Representative Crummell, Representative Thatcher, fire away.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, State Representative Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. House Bill 3090 was sponsored by myself and Representative Thatcher and Representatives Flores and Greenlick to try to bring some integrity, some further integrity, I should say, back to the balloting process. Some of the things that occurred in Washington last year, I think, have raised some concerns. And what we're trying to do really is more of a preventative action here to make sure that those types of things can't happen here in Oregon. It does. It requires the clerks and Secretary of State to ensure the highest security possible in the ballot counting. It also makes it a Class C felony to tamper with drop sites. The bill will eliminate. I'm reading on the wrong sheet here.
I can take yours. That's okay.
You go ahead. take off and go.
Are you stealing her testimony?
Yeah, I am stealing her testimony. So let me go back to my testimony.
Can we have a bill that protect the security of somebody's
testimony? We sure can.
But she'll pick up where I left off. One of the primary goals, as I mentioned, is to increase the integrity. Last November, there were several incidences reported of people making makeshift type of drop boxes in front of libraries and malls and that sort of thing, and they were not official and not always trustworthy. Anymore, we've kind of become more a state of vote by drop box, which is fine. I mean, people get their ballots in the mail, and they can choose to mail them in if they'd like to, or they can take them to a variety of drop boxes. And we've also heard reports of several counties getting 40 to 50% of their total ballots at the drop sites within the last 2 or 3 days of the election. So the popularity of the drop sites of official sites is making it more important that they be as secure as possible. More drop sites are to add convenience for the voters. This bill does call for more drop sites in the larger counties, and that will help cut down, I think, on lines that we hear forming at 7:59 on election night. There are a couple of other things that I think I would just like to point out. Actually, let me turn it over to Representative Thatcher.
Okay. Representative Thatcher.
Yes, I am Kim Thatcher, representative for House District 25, Newburgh, St. Paul, and Kaiser. Now, picking up where he left off, he talked a little bit about the ballot counting area security. It also makes it a Class C felony to tamper with drop sites. Like we mentioned before, don't want to become a Washington state. It eliminates the stray ballots from the recount process and helps reduce the chances of what happened in Washington state. We don't want a few hundred ballots turning up under a water cooler a month after the election has been certified. But I would like to add that the county clerks would have the opportunity to contest their own election and get a judge to decide whether those can be included in any recount. The bill went through a number of revisions, and each time, I believe it got better and better. Along the way, we picked up support from Oregon Association of County Clerks, the Oregon League of Women Voters. We have, until I see that they're here to testify otherwise, the Secretary of State's Office, AARP, and the American Association of University Women. All these folks agreed at the time of our committee meeting that we need more safeguards in the system. And, if you have any questions, we're here for you.
Okay. Representative Thatcher, Representative Crummell, whoever wants to answer. I was particularly interested in the Section 9 provision that I think, Representative Thatcher, you mentioned about, and I assume it directly relates to Washington State, where the King County found, I don't remember the amount, but found 500 ballots that hadn't been counted in the original tally. As I read this, those ballots would then be prohibited in the vote count. Is that correct?
Unless the county clerks contested, there is a valve for that.
Okay.
They can contest their own election, give it to a judge. They can decide to include it. It takes the onus off of the county clerks. Actually, they were relieved to have that taken from them, so
okay.
It's not so politicized.
All right. Just had the experience of a very close election my first time around, so I'm very familiar with the vote counts. Other questions? Senator Shields.
This morning on the Senate floor, we had the joy of having Oregon State's baseball team. Later in the morning, I was surprised to have some other very fine young people from Oregon State University who came to talk to me about this bill. And they were concerned because on OSU's campus, there's only one real drop box, and it's buried in the back of the library someplace. A lot of the kids used a box that under this bill would be outlawed. Is there any way that you can... And the University of Oregon and Oregon State are the only two universities in the state that even have official boxes, and like Oregon State only had one. Is there any way we can take this situation into account, amend this bill, or do something? I mean, we're telling young people we want them to vote. They set up a system where they collect ballots, and now we're making that system kind of go away. It would seem to me that student governments on every campus ought to be allowed to set up some boxes or something. I'm just concerned about the double message we're giving to young people.
Sure.
Do you want to do that? It doesn't matter. I was just going to say that the county clerks can set up official drop sites anywhere they choose to. So they can appeal to their county clerk's office and ask for more official drop sites on the campus.
I'm just wondering why that hasn't happened, why they don't have them all over campuses, especially as big as Oregon State or University of Oregon.
I think
or even OIT, it wouldn't matter.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, I think you raise a very good point. And I think, what I would encourage the student governments to do would be to figure out where on campus, whether it's one place or several places, where they would want to have drop sites located. Go to the county clerks and work with the county clerks in asking them to set up more than one official drop site. That way, you know that it comes under the auspices of the security of the balloting system. You know that the ballots are going to be picked up or delivered to the county clerk's office in a timely fashion so that they're going to be counted. You know that that because it's an official site, there's parameters in place so that the ballot actually does get to the county clerk. So that's what I, as opposed to changing the bill and allowing for unofficial drop sites, what I would encourage is the student governments to work with the county clerks to address the issue in that fashion.
Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, I guess I would say I'm somewhat cynical that the county elections people might not always listen to the university students, and somehow I'd like to see something in the bill that would make it a little stronger so that those kids that were trying to get the vote would actually have both the impetus to do it and maybe some input on not just begging their county elections people, but kind of saying, to the county elections people, let's put one here and have some assurance that they're going to be heard. I don't know quite what to do. I'm just struck by the testimony I heard this morning, or the visit I had this morning.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, sorry.
What's his name?
Good old one here. I found the clerks to be very easy to work with, and I think that if the student body president or senate president of a university were to contact their county clerk and asked us to talk with them, I wouldn't wait until October of 2006, or I wouldn't wait until the 1st of May of 2006. I would do it in September of this year. once they and or even in December of this year, so that they as a school body, they make a determination where they think it would be most useful to have official drop sites set up. And a campus the size of Oregon State or University of Oregon, where or even Portland State, where you've got 20,000-30,000 students, having more than one drop site really makes sense. And I would think that the county clerks would respond positively to that.
Hope so.
I hope they would too.
Sir Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This makes certain conduct subject to a Class C felony. What's the penalty for a Class C felony?
You cut me a little off guard.
Senator Ringo, Madam Chair, it's 5 years and how much?
5 years and a lot of money.
$25,000.
Okay.
That's a lot. But we're trying to bring it up equal. Well, right now it's a penalty to mess with a mailbox, and that's essentially an equal, even though that comes under federal regulations. We just wanted to bring the drop box up to the same level.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Just a comment and maybe another question. I see this in judiciary all the time where people think that if you throw some huge penalty, it'll prevent potentially bad conduct. And really, people that may be guilty of the conduct are never going to know of the statute. So let's say they deface some ballot box drop-off somewhere just with graffiti or something, then they're subject to 5 years in jail. I'm cognizant of ratcheting up the penalties on conduct that, a lot of us have done some things like that out of mischief that don't warrant 5 years in jail. Another question, though, if I may.
Senator Ringo.
How does this impact somebody gathering ballots in their neighborhood, for example? I mean, can somebody still go door-to-door picking up ballots?
Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, this was an interesting conversation that we had on the House side. And the idea of somebody having a party at their house and encouraging people to bring their ballots, I don't believe there's anything although gathering language was specifically taken out on the House side, and again, that was one of the things that was negotiated as part of the -5 amendments that ended up going into the bill, to specifically exclude gathering type of language. If people want to go to a party, and if they want to bring their ballots there, I don't think there's anything there that prohibits a host from saying that bring your ballots if you want to. But that's in the event of they're just having a get together. What we're really trying to prevent is someone setting up a ballot box in front of their house or on a corner somewhere and that sort of thing and trying to make it look official when in fact it's not. And so if drop sites have to be officially designated by the county clerk.
Just to follow up, is the definition? I don't see it in here. Maybe it is the definition of a drop site. Is that defined in this bill?
Another interesting conversation.
It is in. Let's see. I believe it is in section 6, and it is in section 6. So on page 2 of the engrossed bill. It talks about in an election conducted, a person except for the county officials can establish a place of deposit for ballots, and then it goes through and talks about how the clerks will do that and the training for those places, and then particularly in sub 3, a county clerk may establish permanent receptacles, and in sub 4, a county clerk shall maintain places of deposits, and then talks about the population bases, and those are minimums. Of course, the county clerks can go to a higher number if they so choose. I think that section will answer the questions that you had. And again, this language was worked out very carefully with the County Clerks Association some other folks.
Okay, thank you. Are some county clerks or elections officials going to follow?
Yes, we've got Mr. Kaufman coming up.
All right.
And I just, Representative Thatcher, the Secretary of State's office, just to clarify, is only concerned about Section 9, is my understanding of the bill. So
hopefully that can address. But can I add one thing?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ringo, you brought up earlier that people might not know about the penalty. What was earlier in the bill, or earlier in the development of this bill, we were toying with the idea of making somebody be staffing all of these places of deposit. Well, there are these mailbox-type places that are out there that are secure, but there was some concern brought up by people out there that, you know, somebody could just drop a match down in a district that they know heavily favors whatever opposing party and destroy all those ballots. And what's the penalty for that? So we thought we'd bring that up with equal to a mailbox. And that's where that evolved from.
I understand there's some match there. I just...
Right. Well, and Senator Ringo, I'm assuming this bill did not come out of did not go through the budget committee process.
No.
That tells me it has a fiscal less than approximately $50,000, so that tells me that they didn't anticipate numerous prosecutions this particular provision. That's just a guess, but that's my sense. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us this afternoon. Any other
If I may, I would just like to clarify that with regards to Section 9, we, as I mentioned, we did clarify that with the county clerks. And also on the House side, had the Secretary of State's office told us that they thought there was still a problem with that, we would have been happy to address it. But I think that the way the language is there, it does give the county clerks and the court the ability to, if there's ballots that were not counted as part of the original tally, that they can be then added in later.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Any other legislators in the room? If I'm missing, make sure I'm not missing anyone. Okay. All right. Let's continue on the public hearing on House Bill 3090, since we're already open. Mr. Kaufman, Mr. Lindback, and then we've got last two, Mr. Mishler and Mr. Schaffer. So... Yes. Mr. Kaufman, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Brown. John Kaufman, Multnomah County Director of Elections, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks, since Annette Newingham is on vacation.
Lucky
we're here.
You.
Yeah. We're here in support of the English version. There are several pieces of the bill that we think will be a benefit. It adds a recognition of the 24-hour permanent drop boxes. We have long had concerns as election officials with the unofficial ballot boxes. We have concerns often raised by voters wanting to they should give their ballot to someone if it's an unofficial site, and we try to discourage them from doing that. We tell people that, first of all, this is vote by mail. You have the opportunity to put a stamp on the ballot and return it at your doorstep or out at on your street corner. We have official ballot boxes. In Multnomah County, every library and during the regular library hours, evenings and weekends, many counties have public buildings with official drop sites. We are establishing those 24-hour mailboxes. We have 5 now in Multnomah County, and we're looking for more. The way the bill reads, requiring one for every 20,000. We currently have more than that standard in Multnomah County at this point, and I don't think that's an unreasonable standard. And finally, another piece of the bill that we like is that it requires that we train people who are going to be official observers. And considering the experience we had last November, it would have been nice to have had that opportunity then. So as the representative of the association, we'd encourage you to support the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Kaufman, in terms of the training of official watchers, any concerns about a fiscal impact in terms of on the counties on that particular provision?
Chair Brown, I don't think so. I mean, one of the things that we have always wanted to do is have observers. We have a very open process, and we encourage people to come watch. What's nice about the idea of training the official observers is because, you know, they're there for a longer period of time, and they're often raising questions. So I think this is a very good opportunity for us to provide training for them.
I want to also follow up on Senator Ringo's question about sort of group, like somebody in the neighborhood having a ballot party and having everybody come over and marking the ballots and collecting it. My reading of the bill is that is not prohibited by this particular bill. Is that your understanding as well?
Based upon the testimony on the House side, I guess I would agree with you. And our only concern is, as election officials, that we get the ballots. You know, we discourage people from doing these unofficial activities, but our concern purely is to get the ballots.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Mr. Kaufman? Sorry, Ringo.
Well, is Mr. Lindbeck going to go? Or?
Yeah, and I forgot. So, Mr. Lindbeck, go.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindbeck, Director of the Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office. First of all, I want to congratulate the sponsors of this legislation and issue an apology for a late problem with this bill. And I am bringing it up late. I recognize that. But in upon further review of this bill, we do have some issues with Section 9 that I wanted to talk about today. I'd like to preface my comments by saying that Oregon has established a tradition in elections that we think is a good one, and that is that if a voter makes a mistake and there's time to rectify it, we try to help the voter do that. The replacement ballot process is a good example of that. If a voter makes a mistake and on their ballot and wants a new one to make sure that the machine can read it correctly, we have a process for that. And if a voter forgets to sign their ballot return envelope, elections officials try as hard as they can to contact that voter and have them come in and sign their ballot before the 8 p.m. deadline on election day. In turn, if an elections official makes a mistake, particularly one that disenfranchises voters in any way, and there's a way to fix it before election day, we generally have a process to fix that as well. And a good example is in a printing error on a ballot. If a county makes a printing error, we have a process in place to send a correct ballot to the voter affected by that error. Section 9 of this bill represents a huge policy change, and I feel it's important to call it to your attention. It states that if election staff in a county makes an error and the ballots are not counted in the initial tally of votes, those ballots may not be counted in a recount. So in other words, if it's the mistake of the election workers, it's the voters who suffer. I believe this section is inspired by the unfortunate situation in King County, Washington, where the county discovered that it had by mistake not counted 116 absentee ballots. These discoveries occurred both after the initial certification of the election and after the manual recount in Washington and subsequent certification of that manual recount. King County is now undergoing a multi-layered examination of operations in its elections office to determine why these problems occurred and to try to keep them from happening again. Nowhere, though, was it proven in litigation or in follow-up reviews that what happened in King County was anything other than errors by county election staff and county workers. While this bill was in the House, elections officials encouraged the sponsors to make this section not quite so heavy-handed as it was over there by making sure that the ballots could be counted so if a judge rules in a post-election contest that they could be counted as part of that contest. I believe the sponsors, as they testified today, thought that they were doing what they were fixing it when they proposed the amendments that ended up in the House version of the bill. But upon further review, there's still a problem, we believe. It's our belief that the context of election statutes are written, and it seems pretty clear when you read them, it's 258.065, that a judge can only affirm or set aside the entire results of a particular race in an election if there's a contest of an election. a judge in a contest of election cannot select certain categories of ballots and order them to be counted or not counted. That would not protect the interests of the victims in this kind of situation, in this case the voters, in making sure that their votes get counted. And I think if we all recall the publicity that came out of King County, that is one group of unhappy voters, the fact that their voters never got counted in the process, and they never did. We think the current system in Oregon works well. We only do manual recounts. We don't start with a machine recount and then do a manual recount and do it over and over again. At any time in an election process, a voter or other aggrieved party can appeal the decision of an elections official to a judge under ORS 246-910. Thus, if we had a situation where such an error occurred in Oregon, the county clerk, who is elected or appointed to their position because they're trusted to make these decisions, would decide whether or not those ballots should be counted. And it's standard practice in difficult cases for clerks to communicate with the elections division about difficult situations so that interpretations from one county to the next are in accordance with state law and consistent from one county to the next. Any party that disagrees with the clerk's decision can immediately appeal to a judge under ORS 246-910, and the judge can question the elections officials and decide whether the decision was proper under the law. Under this bill, the county clerk is removed from the process. The decision is that despite who is at fault, the votes will not be counted. Why remove the clerk? There is no reason to do so when there is an appeal process already in place. Upon further review of the section, we believe the interests of the voters are best served by keeping the current system in place or repairing the section in some way to make sure that the interests of the voters are protected. And I believe the past history with this group of sponsors is that they're more than willing to do that, and we're more than willing to work with them on this section and try to, if they're interested and you're interested, take these concerns into account. I have one last comment on the training section. You'll notice that in the training section of this bill, it has no dates in it required of when this training is to take place. And I can envision situations where observers may want to start observing very late in the process and not be allowed to do so because they didn't go to an earlier training. Because sometimes these issues in elections can come up just like that, and what has been a uneventful, non-controversial election can suddenly become very controversial. And so we will work with the clerks, I just wanted to put that on the record, to establish some, in rule, some parameters around which this training should take place to make sure that if the situation arises that they can provide training on a fairly expedited basis.
All right.
Thank you.
Questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. The sponsors of the bill say this bill prohibits unofficial ballot drop sites. I'm wondering where in the bill it says that. How does this bill do that?
Well, if we talk a little bit more informally and less in sort of legal language, what we're talking about here is a box. That's what we're really talking about here, that under current law is required to have a label that says unofficial drop site. And what this bill would say is that there will be no more of those. But it's our interpretation, and that would be in section
6.
Yeah, on page 4, lines 24 through 26.
Sub 19 there, you remove that language. I understand
yeah.
that. But, okay, I mean, fine, you remove the language that says you have a provision for a drop box that's labeled not an official drop site. But nowhere do I see in this bill any place prohibiting unofficial drop sites. You do reference place of deposit. I know that's in Section 6, but place of deposit is not defined. So why can't somebody set up an unofficial drop site? And by the way, now they don't have to label it unofficial drop site because we're removing that. And they say it's not a place of deposit. It's an unofficial box.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I'm not sure that I can defend all the language in this bill. I do know that the intent is to say no more unofficial drop boxes. And by the conversation I heard on the House side, that the ability to collect ballots on behalf of people that think that that's okay, that they'll hand their ballot over to somebody else for delivery to an elections office, that will be retained.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Ringo.
You know, I know people that have voting parties, and they put a big bowl out there or a shoebox or something, and I guess you can say, well, that's not a, quote, place of deposit. And then you can have all other shades of gray here where you go to a box in the street corner or a box in a church or a box in a box at the Sierra Club, for example, and, you know, it's not a place of deposit but we don't know for sure because it's not defined.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I do think that would be helpful to define that more. I mean, we did give thought to that earlier. But we have a variety of election laws in which the conversation in the legislative committee, it seems like the intent is clear and that we're able to, either by rule or whatever, flesh that out. And we'd be happy to try and do that. I think we understand what the rule is here, and that's people aren't supposed to place a box somewhere that's unattended, that's subject to some sort of possible tampering, and it's unofficial and unattended and not supervised, and that those ballots are in an insecure situation. That's my belief, and the sponsors could speak better to it than me, probably.
And Senator Ringo,
but that's what this bill is about.
Yes. As I read the language in lines 27 and 28, page 2, I think that was clearly the intent of what the bill was trying to do, but you may be right. We may need to define it. And, you know, I agree with you, whether you're using literally a pulpit or a bowl, kitchen bowl, you know, that may or may not be in violation of those two sentences, of those two words.
And, Madam Chair, what Mr. Limbach said is something that I think is very important. He's intending to get to unattended boxes. At least that's what he said, boxes where maybe they stick it out on the street corner and nobody's there to guard it. Maybe that's one way to get at it, so that if you've got some box in a group or a club or a church, at least you have some custodian of some sort that's continually responsible and then delivers those ballots to the official drop site. But, I mean, if that's the intent, it's not specified.
Sir Ferrioli.
Madam Chairman, it sounds like a negative. What I perceive that this department doing is saying we are going to define and delineate where official drop boxes are. All others, you know, except no substitutions. All others are not legal. And I don't know that we're intending to kick the door on a balloting party and snag the fishbowl and put irons on everybody in the room, although that might be a colorful alliteration. The point is, if you're going to advertise a drop box, and I think that's what people want to know, is where are the official drop boxes? It has to be approved by the county elections officials. So I see us arguing about trying to prevent it by defining in the negative. Can't do that. You need to be affirmative about where those drop boxes are, and I think that's what the bill does.
Mr. Rettlinger, can you help us out at all? I think what we're struggling with is what is an official place of deposit for ballots, and does that include drop sites, et cetera? I don't know how much of the questions you heard.
Madam Chair, for the record, Ted Rettlinger from the Legislative Council. I didn't hear many of the questions, but I'm somewhat familiar with the issue because it was addressed in the House committee as well, where people attempted to craft an exception for gatherings in people's living rooms, etc. That was very difficult to define. What this is intended to do is prohibit people from setting up on a street corner in any public place, as sometimes happens now, a place where people can come and deposit their ballots, and the people who set up the site then take them and deliver them to the elections officials. It's intended to specify that it's the county clerks who get to determine where the ballot drop sites are and prohibit people from setting up those either intended or unintended public drop sites.
So in lines 27 and 28 on page 2, clarification with the use of the word public might be helpful.
Madam Chair, yes, that might narrow the scope a little bit, and it would, however, open the door to interpretation of what's public, what's private. Is a church public? Is a church private? Is a gathering to which all members of a political party are invited in somebody's home, is that public or private? Any way that you address this, you're going to end up with difficulties of interpretation that the people who enforce the statute are going to have to make some determinations about.
And that was going to be my next question. Is a drop site in a church or a school public? Well, obviously, in a school it would be. A church, I think, was arguably not public. But you could have the... Okay. All right. Any other questions for Mr. Rentlinger, Senator Farrielly?
Yeah, I think getting at this issue, I think it's thrusters to try to prohibit people from soliciting drop ballots to other than an officially approved site, a public invitation to solicit ballots to other than an approved site should be prohibited. And I think that gets to the issue of not scooping up a bunch of unintended consequences here and really focusing on the idea that there has to be an approved site. The things that I think people get nervous about is different groups or organizations soliciting the dropping of ballots and advertising for the collection in an unapproved site.
All right. Other questions?
Senator
Rangel, Senator Atkinson, sorry.
Did the Secretary of State's office work with the proponents of the bill with your concerns on Section 7 before this hearing?
Section 9?
Section 9, I'm sorry.
Senator Atkinson? No, I was working on this right up to the few minutes before the hearing. On the House side, we did weigh in, and again, we thought it was fixed. But upon further review of this, particularly the review of the contest of elections statutes, we believe it needs some more work, and I apologize for that. But.
Sam Ringo.
So let's say you've got some fraternal organization, like the Lions Club, for example, that they have a drop box that they leave over the period of a couple of weeks for dropping off ballots. Can they do that?
Under this bill.
Under this bill?
My interpretation under this bill is that they cannot.
That they cannot? What if the Lions Club had a meeting and they said, okay, we're putting a box out here for your ballots. We're going to come and talk about the issues for the public on this election, and after the meeting we'll gather and you can put your ballots in here and we'll take them all. Can they do that?
Well, I think that's the gray area in this bill. Based on the discussion that I've heard on this bill, I would argue that they could, but they shouldn't leave that. You know, they ought to take those ballots immediately to the county elections office or drop site. If they put them in a fishbowl or a hat or a box or something at their meeting, so that nobody can argue that those ballots were left unattended or unsupervised or unsecure.
Madam Chair, the difference between hypothetical one and hypothetical two is that under number one it would have been left unsupervised, and under number two they were always supervised.
That's where I'm drawing the line on this bill.
And so if it's unsupervised, then that becomes some unofficial place of deposit. And if it's supervised, we're not defining it as a place of deposit.
Again, Senator Ringo, that's how I interpret it.
And but so it doesn't say that in the bill.
Right. And,
okay.
And so, Mr. Limbach, just to pick up on that, how would you make the distinction between, did you use the Lions Club?
Lions Club.
Lions Club, church, and the YMCA.
Here's the way I think about it. The kind of event that Senator Ringo was talking about, where they had an event, everybody was
party,
there.
Everybody comes in, drops their ballots, it's gone, and it goes right to the elections office. That's
correct.
Okay. But neither the Wine or the Lions Club nor a church could have a box saying, have a box, can't say anything on it, that everybody knows is the drop site, but, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Correct.
All right. All right. Any other questions? It's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you very much. All right, next three. We are at, next two. Mr. Alan Mishler.
Madam Chair, I just want to ask before you go, Mr. Rollinger, do you agree with the interpretation Mr. Limbach just gave?
Does the lawyer agree with the practitioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I was worried you were going to ask that question. Because I believe you're correct. The way that this bill is written, it could clearly be interpreted more broadly than that interpretation, because it simply says that a person may not establish a place of deposit for ballots except an elections official. It seems to me that you could interpret that phrase, place of deposit, a little bit more broadly and cover the situation where people come to the Lions meeting and there's a box there and the ballots are put into the box. Clearly, it's going to cover the situation where they set out a box and it's unintended, anybody. Seems to me that it's also going to cover a situation where somebody sets out a box and does attend it and stays there for a week. You know, that is going to be prohibited. The gray area, as Mr. Limbach mentions, are those other gatherings where somebody says, oh, by the way, if you want to give me your ballot, I'll turn it in. At some point, you cross a line between offering to do somebody a favor and establishing a place of deposit. It seems to me that if your intent is to gather ballots from a number of people and deliver them to the clerks, then that is more likely than not to be a place of deposit prohibited by this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one more question. Do you know the penalty for a Class C felony?
I believe it's a maximum 5 years and
a lot of money. Yes, a lot of money. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us. Of course, Mr. Rutlinger, you didn't have a choice, but we appreciate you being here anyway. Mr. Mishler and Mr. Schaefer. Anybody else wishing to weigh in on House Bill 3090? We're not going to work the bill today. Obviously, there's some language issues that need to be examined. So, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Brown, members of the Senate Committee on Rules. For the record, my name is Alan Mishler. I'm a board member of the Oregon Student Association, and I'm the State Affairs Task Force Director for the Associated Students of Oregon State University. And this is my first testimonial here in Salem, so excuse me if I get a little nervous here.
Hey.
Before I read the testimonial, I'd like to respond to a statement made by the representative sponsoring the bill earlier. ASOSU has tried to work with the Benton County clerks to get more drop boxes at Oregon State, and last election we were unable to, and the only drop box we had was actually moved from a high traffic area in our Memorial Union to a side table in the library, and so we did attempt, from what I was told today, that we did try to get more drop boxes and we were not able to. Now, onto the testimonial. The Oregon Student Association represents over 100,000 students in the Oregon University system, Lane Community College, and Oregon Health and Science University. On behalf of the Oregon Student Association, I speak in opposition of House Bill 3090. The Oregon Student Association has run nonpartisan campus-based voter registration drives for years. These voter registration efforts help bring young people into the political process early. We are concerned about attempts to change the system in ways that would make it more difficult for college students' voices to be heard. We are especially concerned with one aspect of this bill, the barring of unofficial ballot drop boxes. Students across the state use unofficial drop boxes to increase voter turnout on campuses by providing easily accessible drop sites for students. For example, at OSU, the student government used an unofficial drop box on the 1st and 2nd of last November to collect ballots from last-minute student voters. The drop box was located in the Memorial Union Quad, a highly visible and heavily trafficked area. The drop box was secured with a lock, labeled unofficial, staffed at all times by at least two ASOSU representatives, and was transferred to the official on-campus drop box every couple of hours. Due to the accessibility of our site, we collected hundreds of ballots that may never otherwise made it to the official drop box, which is located in the corner of the library, as Senator Shields mentioned earlier. And the event that we held on November 2nd was a large event in a Memorial Union quad where we had a table set up. It was always staffed by at least two representatives of ASOSU. We had tables with nonpartisan voter education pamphlets. The table was visible from all sides. And we made a great effort to keep the credibility there. And we did a lot of voter education, a lot of nonpartisan voter education leading up to the election as well. So we did take great care in making sure that the students of Oregon State's voices were heard in that election.
Mr. Mishler, do you know roughly how many students were registered to vote during the last election cycle at your campus?
I don't know offhand, but I can get that information for you.
I'd be very curious.
Thousands.
But I'll get the exact number.
That's great.
Okay. Oregon State University and the University of Oregon are two public campuses with official drop boxes. However, even at OSU, we still used an unofficial box to increase visibility. Most community colleges and public universities do not have official drop boxes on campus, and they rely exclusively on unofficial drop boxes to turn out their student vote. Unofficial drop boxes are especially important to our regional institutions like Southern Oregon University, Eastern Oregon University, and the Oregon Institute of Technology, where collecting ballots through canvassing or other methods is especially difficult. OIT had a huge ballot box that the student government locked at all times. The associated students of OIT would have two people at all times escort the ballots to the county elections office. Mm-hmm. Students across the state have worked to increase the number of official drop boxes on college campuses without success. Unofficial drop boxes are the next best option to ensure students are actively engaged in the political process. This bill, as currently drafted, would severely limit the accessibility and opportunity for many students to vote on campuses in Oregon, in turn reducing voter turnout and muzzling the voice of students on Election Day. The Oregon Student Association urges the committee to oppose House Bill 3090A as it is currently drafted.
Thank you. Mr. Schaefer.
Yes. I'm here representing SEIU Local 503. That's a Service Employees International Union. And we're in opposition to this bill for a lot of the reasons that you guys have been talking about.
And I need your name for the record.
Joe Schaefer.
Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I mean, in the discussion here, I mean, we've just had, like, the sponsors of the bill and several of the drafters actually talking about the intent of this, and I still have a lot of questions in my head about what is an established place for dropping off ballots. And the thing that worries me most about this would be the cooling effect that it would have. I mean, we've always been told, and I'm a true believer in that democracy is not a spectator sport. We all have to participate. And I have participated since I came to Oregon in the electoral process, a lot with the Oregon Student Association, where I did a tremendous amount of work registering students to vote, but also getting them to hand in ballots. And what we did there, in order to increase turnout in the 2000 election, where we were actually able to target student-heavy precincts and meet the county average for the 18 to 34-year-old age group, which was really quite a feat at that time. We had students going through dorms. We had students on most corners trying to get people to turn in ballots. We were registering them to vote as much as we could at that point. And the thing that worries me about this is that you've got students who don't show up to class until the last week of September. And in order for the county elections office to have training for them to participate or to recruit students to participate in the process or to elect officers that for a student government would be really pretty tough under the timeline that you have in the fall. And just the technical questions about what is a drop box or a place of deposit. Does this mean that as long as I don't have a box, if I put them in my pocket or hold them in my hand and just continue to walk around campus or show up at work sites, which we often do right now the last few days before an election, we're there for shift change so that employees who, because of their you know, tight schedules, you know, rough lives. I mean, my wife and I just had twins, and let me tell you, it's tough to make it to the post office, right? I mean, that's no joke, right? So being able to stand there at the entryway to public buildings collecting ballots is an important service that we provide to our members. And it's not clear to me whether or not we could continue to do this under this bill. I mean, and if we could do it, as long as we didn't have a box in our hands, or if we could do it if we moved around because we didn't establish a place, or if we could do it because we didn't advertise it, none of those things are clear in this language, and it really concerns me about the chilling effect that it might have on people's participation in the electoral process. And without clarity about these things, I really get nervous. So, we urge your no vote on this bill because of those reasons.
All right. Thank you very much. I know folks have questions, but we need to move on. We really appreciate you joining us. You did great your first time. We look forward to seeing you back.
Thank you.
For the proponents, I would certainly encourage you. We're going to take some time and explore some of the language in this bill. You can obviously see that there's some concerns with some of the language, but I would specifically ask that you come forward with some, if we have any cases of fraud or anything specific that the bill, I understand the general concepts, but if there's anything in Oregon that specifically has been a problem that this bill was designed to fix, that would be extremely helpful. And, Senator Ringo, I'm going to put you in charge of corralling this and bringing it back and by the end of next week. Assuming we're still here.
Okay, Madam Chair, I mean, given that charge, then I would ask the people who have an interest in this bill to contact my staff. Let's say Michael Salvaggio, and let's set something up as soon as we can.
Great. All right. Thank you all very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3090. That was just a very fascinating conversation. And Representative Dalto, you are here, I believe, on House Bill 3073. I'm so sorry. I didn't see you. There were too many people blocking your beautiful face. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3073. Come on up. Ms. Harris, you can always bring your friends. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I didn't know it was Bodkin.
I'm giving you
the Does that help or hurt
blow.
The bill, man?
House Bill 3073A modifies some of the statutes governing procedures for investigating a report of abuse at residential training homes operated by the Department of Human Services.
Take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Billy Dalto, representing Oregon's 21st House District here in Salem. I'm going to make this very quick, very brief. This is a great bill that helps the people that work at the Oregon State Hospital and state-operated group homes conduct their daily workday without living in fear that if they defend themselves when a patient is attacking them, that they might subject themselves to an abuse charge. It's a complicated thing to do to be a psychiatric worker at a state-operated group home or the state hospital where you have mentally ill patients who can become aggressive at times. And in fact, there have been cases where individual psychiatric workers have been targeted for violent attacks by patients, and you really can't defend yourself presently and pull somebody off of you, or let alone go and pull somebody off of one of your coworkers or colleagues if you're being attacked without potentially subjecting yourself to a damaging abuse charge which follows you on your employment record. This is a very important bill to me because I have a lot of people in my community that work at the state hospital, state-operated group homes. It's great. I have this. I have one household that's right along beautiful Bush Park here, where one of the spouses works as a psychiatric nurse at the state hospital, and one works as a technician, psychiatric technician, and it's really an interesting deal. Long story short, it's a good bill. Came out unanimously from the House. I just want to describe for you the process that we put this bill together. When the bill was originally drafted, it was broader in scope. We narrowed the scope to the state-operated group home and the hospital, put a work group together where the Oregon Advocacy Commission was represented, the Department of Human Services, AFSCME Union was represented, and a couple of legislators, and we sat down all together and worked out a compromise language that let this bill go forward without objection. It's a good bill, and I encourage you to pass it. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent the doctors and the nurses at the Oregon State Hospital, and we also represent the direct care staff in all of the state-operated group homes around the state that care for the most disabled and most the most seriously retarded and mentally ill individuals living in those homes. Every session, AFSCME comes in with a new poster child for the kind of random violence and abuse that occurs at the state hospital or within this environment. And in the interest of time, we're not going to do the poster child this year.
That's an important story.
All right. We're going to do
the poster child. They're going to let this
But I can tell you that our direct care staff and our doctors and nurses face random attacks by clients nearly every day on the job. Some of them have been seriously and permanently disabled and injured as a result of those attacks. Nothing is going to stop that from occurring. All this bill does is say that if the staff person acts in a reasonable manner using the force allowed under rule and by law, as established by case law, to defend themselves, then they will not, then they can propose, if there are later abuse charges filed against them, that they can offer an affirmative defense that it was indeed self-defense and that they did not assert or exert any more force than was necessary than to protect themselves or another staff person. This bill has additional protections built into it. It provides that if a client or their family members or the department feel that the individual was indeed guilty of abuse, there are appeal processes for both sides, which will allow for a process to continue. And I do want to say that our union nor our, my colleagues have any interest in protecting anybody who would abuse a client. It won't allow any abuse to occur that's not occurring now, and it will help us sort of weed out the problems and do it in a manner which allows staff to defend themselves in a reasonable manner and protect themselves from long-term negative effects on their employment record. And with that, we encourage your support.
Thank you. I received a letter from Representative Barnhart about a technical error in the bill. Either one of you see this letter?
Madam Chair, I have not seen the letter.
I read the bill, I believe it addressed at least the amended version, but the letter is dated June 17th, so I'll get you guys a copy. So,
I know that Representative Barnhart mentioned on the floor of the House that he liked the bill, but he did not feel that it covered the protection of a colleague. So if you pulled a client off of another staff person, and to be really honest with you, I don't know that that's the case, but I don't know it's not the case. I mean, I understand that that was one of his concerns, that the staff should be able to protect each other as well, as long as appropriate force was used.
All right. That makes sense. All right. Any questions? Thank you very much. You're welcome to hang around if you don't have anything else to do.
Watch it on my television, Madam Chair.
All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3073? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 3073. Senator Ringo, would you like to go back to House Bill 2050? Was that your note?
That would be great.
Okay. We're going to go back up to 2050. I'm going to skip out for a moment. You got the gavel. Don't go crazy.
But, Madam Chair, I wanted you here.
I'll be back in a moment.
Okay. Well, committee, Senate Bill 2050 is the bill I introduced, and we've had hearings on it in the Judiciary Committee, and the reason it wasn't passed out of there is because there's one amendment that wasn't quite completed in time. And the bill has to do with a issue that was raised to me by a constituent. And there was a little girl, 5 or 6 years old, who had been sexually molested by her grandfather. And the grandfather spent some time in incarceration and then came back out to the public and moved back into the community just within a mile or so of the victim. And then the victim and her mom ran into the offender in the grocery store. And it reignited the unpleasant experience and some of the memories. of the abuse. And so the bill is that if an offender of sexual abuse comes out of incarceration, they have to move to a location at least 3 miles away from the victim. There are some mechanical issues, because you can ask, how do they know? Right now, in order to be placed in housing, the offender must receive the approval of the probation officer or the parole officer. There was an issue raised in Judiciary Committee that said, well, what if the offender is living in a facility or living in, say, a home, and then the victim moves within 3 miles? Mm-hmm. And so we said, well, that's a legitimate concern, and so that is addressed in the Dash 6 amendments. Frankly, it was because of that issue that it didn't pass out of Judiciary. And so that is resolved in the Dash 6 amendments. There was another issue that Multnomah County raised, and that had to do with they have transitional housing or halfway housing, and they wanted to make sure that that wouldn't be a problem, that perhaps the victim lived within 3 miles of the transitional housing, and that was the place the offender had to go. And so we specified that also in the Dash 6 amendments, that if there's a halfway house where the offender is to be housed, and that's also not an issue. Marion County came and testified in Judiciary and raised issues as to the expense of this, and said, well, this will cost them $150,000 because they're going to have to purchase a GIS system to know if one point is 3 miles away from another point. And the sense of the committee was, well, that's kind of silly, because, frankly, you can find that out on MapQuest or other basic computer programs, and really there's no mechanical burden. Just understanding is 1.3 miles away from another point, particularly when you have to analyze the housing issue. The probation officer has to give approval to the housing anyway. So my understanding is that somebody from Marion County is here to testify in opposition to this bill. I think it's an expense issue. At least the sense on Judiciary Committee was that really wasn't a legitimate issue to raise. But that is one potential point of opposition. In any event, all of the members of the Judiciary Committee, everyone, were prepared to vote in favor of the bill, except we didn't have the right amendment done by the close of that committee. So that's just my introduction of House Bill 2050. And since we don't have a chair, Senator Atkinson wonders whether I said my name for the record, and I think Tiffany did. The chair did.
What can we move?
We have a sign-up sheet. Let's go ahead and ask other people to come. And why don't we get the potential opponent, Pat Schreiner? Are you here?
Hi. Good afternoon. Chair Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner. I'm the commander of the Marion County Sheriff's Office Parole and Probation Division, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. We have had some problems with this bill. We've tried to submit some friendly amendments, and we have met with Senator Ringo's staff on this in the past. There continues to be some problems, but I guess this would be a good time for me to bring up our latest amendment that we tried to send by email and voicemail to Senator Ringo's office, and I also submitted to the Senate Rules Committee. And that is in this bill's current format, there really are so many caveats to the enforcement of this bill that it really is going to come off as a paper tiger. If somebody's in transitional housing, they're exempt. If they can make the case that this is not productive to their rehabilitation, they can be exempt. If they're in a county of 130,000 or more, that whole county is, or 130,000 or less, that whole county is exempt. And so what we were, and we know that this bill has good intentions. It's a victim-centered bill. We support that. That makes sense. And we came up with some language. We think that we should take the 3 miles out.
And we think you should, the 3 miles is an arbitrary number. It takes a majority of the counties in this state out of being victim-centered here, and the intent is to be victim-centered. Why shouldn't this impact all 36 counties? We would simply modify the language to indicate that community corrections must work with victims in implementing the supervision plan. And that is really where we think that means that the community corrections would then work individually, because it's not just where they live. It might be where they work. It might be where they attend treatment. It might be where they shop. All of those things the parole and probation officer can work with victims on. And that's really the intent of Senator Ringo's bill, and we think we can work with that. Also, I did testify in opposition to this bill on the other side about one other significant concern we had, and that is on page 2B, line 40, and this has been changed a little bit, I understand. The person demonstrates to the court by preponderance of the evidence that no mental intimidation or pressure was brought to bear during the commission of the crime. In my experience, in our experience in supervising sex offenders in the community, this could actually be potentially damaging to victims. At the time of sentencing, at the time of release on supervision into the community, sex offenders tend to be full of cognitive distortions that have justified and minimized their behavior. So at that time, they could conceivably be challenging this condition because they've really minimized the harm they did, and they think they should be able to live within 3 miles. The other concern, and this comes directly from my own experience in supervising these folks in the past, is too many times you have the significant others, the mothers of victims, that will choose the offender at that time over their own child, over the victim. And so conceivably at this time you could have a parent pressuring their child to say, this is not intimidation, this crime was not coercion. We do not want that to happen at this time. This is why supervision, treatment, and polygraphs are used, because that is something that we really focus on in the first 3 to 6 months to kind of work these sex offenders to get them to make some changes.
Can I push on that a little bit?
Sure.
Say you have a significant other or a mother of a child that's molested, and the child is convinced by the mother to change a position and say, it didn't happen that way, or I wasn't coerced. That would then come under the heading that the person had demonstrated to the court that no mental intimidation or pressure was brought to bear during the commission of the crime. Is that what you're saying?
Senator Shields, that's correct.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Mr. Schreiner, I appreciate your testimony. One of the problems with a bill like this is that you balance making it too strict with making it too loose. That's why we settled on not enforcing this in low population counties, because it creates problems of its own. And it just seems to me, I mean, you raise some legitimate points, but to me this strikes close to the right balance of making it too strict and too loose. And I guess I would just ask you, maybe right after this hearing we can go outside and chat for a couple minutes and maybe talk about what specific language you would find that would improve it. But I'd like to see if we can make it better from your standpoint.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, and members of the committee, that would be a great idea. I know that when we met with Michael Salvaggio of your staff, I didn't have any good ideas on. I knew I had some problems with this bill, but I didn't have any good ideas on how this could work. And actually, it was the director down in Lane County that crafted this solution. And as soon as I saw it, I went, this makes perfect sense. This is victim-centered, and it really can address the issue. And I wish I would have thought of it, but I didn't.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Schreiner.
Thank you.
Mr. McKean, we'd like to have you come up, but members don't have copies of the amendments yet, so we'll give it a couple of minutes, and then I understand you're under time deadline as well. So we're going to try and get you in and out of here as quickly as possible. Ms. Schenkel, Senator Ringo, do you want to testify on House Bill 2050?
I did, Madam Chair, and you got up and left. I'm not kidding.
I'll chat with you. Ms. Schenkel, come on up. And Mr. Did you want Michael, Mr. Savaggio?
Yeah.
Mr. Savaggio,
do you want to come up and add anything?
We promise we won't grill you like you would agree with grill Senator Ringo.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice, Legislative Liaison to the Attorney General. I'm here today on behalf of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. I did not bring written testimony, but I'm here to just tell you that the task force supports this bill. They have been describing this through the process as a victim's peace of mind bill. It is one more added step to ensure that victims are not further traumatized by having to face their abusers over and over again, and so we remain in support and would be happy to assist if you do further amendments.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Savaggio.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, my name is Michael Salvaggio. I am a staff member of Senator Charlie Ringo.
We won't hold it against you.
I appreciate that. I would like to quickly address Marion County's concerns to the committee. The original contention of the bill has sufficient exemptions to warrant it as a paper tiger, I think is a statement that the constituent victim in this case would not agree with. It does exempt transitional housing. That is because we recognize that transitional housing is very useful and has been very successful in decreasing the amount of recidivism in these cases, and we do want to encourage that that rehabilitation. The bill does exempt small counties. That was specifically put in place to ensure that a constitutional challenge similar to a bill in Iowa, which was Senate File 2197, did not occur in this case. In Iowa, the bill was successfully challenged on the grounds that it applied to counties in which sufficient residential housing was not available, and therefore eliminated all but very, very little of the of any residentially zoned areas for potential offenders. We didn't want to see a similar constitutional challenge in this case, so we came up with a 3-mile limit for counties of a certain size, which was not arbitrary but painstakingly gone over to maximize the radius and maximize the number of counties that it applied to. The 3 miles, I think it was 2.8 miles, we decided sufficiently separated offenders from their victims in terms of which common community areas, such as post offices, supermarkets, etc., they would be going to, and minimize chance encounters. The suggestion that community corrections would be better off working with the victims in this situation, I would entirely agree with that that contention, but the fact is that in at least one case in our district, we haven't seen it. We've had emails stating that people might have fallen by the wayside in other cases as well, and the fact is that we do appreciate the very, very much the work that our community corrections does, but we also recognize that they at some times may be strained, and we have this one case at least where someone has slipped through the cracks, and we absolutely want to minimize that from happening. There is an exemption for no mental intimidation. We put that in specifically for cases of statutory rape in which we didn't feel that it was warranted that a 19-year-old boyfriend, for example, be banished from a particular neighborhood where he may have been living with his parents if a relationship turned sour. That was something that we didn't think needed to be addressed. And the issue of the significant other guardian who chose living with the offender over the interests of the child is certainly an example that I would not like to see, although I do recognize that I've talked to counsel and decided that it's happened before, and it wouldn't be completely out of the realm of possibility that that would happen. That is something that a judge or parole board is already able to take into account and address as they see fit. And I would say that if that situation is occurring, then this bill might not apply in those situations, but this bill certainly wouldn't attempt to address that horribly grievous problem. And I think that's a completely separate issue. The A6 amendments that you have in front of you make the exemption for transitional housing explicit. They bring the definition into accordance with an existing definition in existing statute, or it's the
bill we passed out of the committee about 2 days ago.
A bill that was recently passed out. And it also makes explicitly clear that the victim cannot move into the offender's radius and essentially bump the offender out of that new neighborhood, but that the victim's radius is in fact portable if they move somewhere that's still out of the offender's radius. If anyone has any additional questions, I will take them. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Questions? I think you're off the hook.
Thank you.
All right. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2050. I need to bring Mr. McKean up on Senate Bill 1000, understanding of your time commitments. Senator Farrelly has a copy of the amendments. That's the only one who does. My understanding is folks are making copies. Here they are. So I guess what we'd like you to have you do is do a walkthrough of the amendments. Right here. After Mr. McKean testifies, I'll close the public hearing. I'm sorry, the work session on Senate Bill 1000. Come back, and I would ask East Side to pick one person to testify on the amendments. We'll come back probably in an hour, maybe an hour and a half, before we work the bill. I want everybody to have an opportunity to read the amendments. Plus, we have a lot of other work to do. So, Mr. McKean, open a work session on Senate Bill 1000. Why don't you walk us through the amendments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug McKean, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I can do the very detailed walkthrough, or I can do a little bit higher level walkthrough, whatever your pleasure is.
What a committee members. Why don't you do a detailed level, please?
If you look at the amendments on page 1, the first three lines show deletions from page 1 of the bill where all the sections in the bill are listed that are amended. It shows that 6 sections have been deleted from the introduced version of Senate Bill 1000. According to the amendment, then, on page 2 of the bill, lines 34 through 45 have been deleted, and then on page 3, lines 1 through 13 have been deleted. That reflects a couple of things. First, that section 4 of the bill amending ORS 659A.012 has been deleted from the bill. That section deals with public policy in the state of Oregon regarding discrimination and affirmative action. That section was deleted. The other part of that, those lines that were deleted on page 2, those are in a section of law, 659A.006, that is also a statement of public policy. Part of that section 006 included an exemption from or for certain churches and religious institutions that permitted them to employ someone of a particular religious faith. It was suggested that that part be moved and put in 659A.030, which is in section 5 of the bill. So we'll see in a minute that that's what's been done. That part has been moved and created as a new subsection in 659A.030. And if you're looking on page 1 of the amendments, that's what happens next. It talks about on page 4 of the bill, there's a new subsection 6. That subsection is the language that we took from 659A.006, and it's now been recreated here in subsection 6 with some form and style changes. There's new language beginning at the bottom of page one of the amendments in subsection 7. And this new subsection says that the provisions of this section, meaning ORS 659A.030, that make it unlawful to a practice to discriminate because of an individual's sexual orientation or because of the sexual orientation of another person with whom the individual associates, do not apply to a bona fide church or sectarian religious institution. And then it has some conditions there. When the church determines that this will serve the purposes of the church, and when the employment involved is closely connected with or related to the primary purposes of the church or the institution. That language is very similar to the language we moved from the policy statement in 659A.006 and moved into 659A.030. In other words, this allows or removes the prohibition on discriminating based on sexual orientation with respect to churches as an employer or other religious institutions such as a school or a church camp or a hospital. Are there any questions about that part? The next amendments are on page 7 of the bill. They're on page 2 of the amendments. This is amending a section of ORA 659A. It's section 421, which deals with housing. And in subsection 9 of that section of the law, there's what's known as the Mrs. Murphy exception, which allows someone who's renting a space in a single-family residence to, in effect, discriminate or not. They can keep people out based on sex or familial status, and this amendment adds sexual orientation to that exception.
So you're saying if Mrs. Murphy doesn't want to rent her cottage, grandmother cottage, to a lesbian, she doesn't have to under this section, correct?
That's correct.
If she doesn't want to rent to a woman, she doesn't have to, correct?
Right.
But if she doesn't have to rent to a man if she doesn't want to.
That's correct.
Okay. And the familial status piece, if the woman is married, she can deny her rental application because she's married or also because she's single? What's the familial status?
Familial status is not marital status. So it's familial status. So it's usually it was designed to prohibit discrimination against a single woman with children.
Okay.
Typically a divorced woman. That's why familial status is added.
Got it. Okay.
It says in your single family home, they're exempt from that prohibition on discrimination.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on that?
Madam Chair, these Mrs. Murphy's provisions are in current statute.
That's right.
Correct.
And what's been added is sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
The next amendments are on page 8 of the bill. In ORS 659A.815, the Commission of Labor can create certain advisory agencies and intergroup relations councils to advise the commissioner and to study various things and to make recommendations. If you look at the bill on page 8 and at lines 38 and 39, one of the things that these councils and the agencies can do is to make recommendations to the commissioner for the development of policies and procedures in general and in specific instances and for programs of formal and informal education. So at that point, after the period, there's some new language being added. If you look at the amendment on page 2, at lines 12 through 14, it says that, however, the advisory agencies and councils may not recommend programs of education of elementary or secondary students relating to discrimination based on sexual orientation.
So essentially, if opponents of the legislation were arguing that this would force us to teach homosexual behavior, if the commission recommended that, this would prohibit the commission from recommending that homosexual behavior be taught in the classroom.
I think that's right. What it says is these agencies and councils that advise the commissioner cannot advise or recommend to the commissioner that certain education be done, education regarding sexual orientation.
Senator Farrelly.
How does that dovetail with the legislation pending on cultural competence?
I don't know.
Probably who's ever drafting the cultural competency legislation. And since it's not, my understanding is not moving through the House, so we can get that answered for you, Senator Farrelly, I'm sure. Okay.
The next amendments are on page 14 of the bill. You'll see the lines 13 through 25 are deleted. The effect of that is it takes out an amendment to ORS section 182.100. That section, again, declares public policy regarding affirmative action. It talks about what the director of affirmative action does. And so that section has been removed from the bill. The next amendment is...
Madam Chairman, I missed that. I got a little bit lost looking at the text. Could I get a line reference on page 14, please?
Sure. Between lines 13 and 25, section 22 of the bill has been removed. And you'll notice when a section of the bill has been removed, a note has been inserted to say that the remaining sections of the bill have not been renumbered. The next amendment...
The statute's still there. The addition of sexual orientation is no longer added in the bill, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
That section of law is not amended by
the
bill.
Thank you.
On page 16, lines 9 through 17 are deleted, which removes an amendment to ORS 243.305. Again, that's a declaration of public policy regarding affirmative action in state government, and so that section has been removed from the bill. Then beginning at lines 39 through 45 of page 16 of the bill, and then all of page 17 of the bill, and going on to the first three lines of page 18 of the bill, those parts have all been removed. The effect of that is to remove sections 27 and 28 from the bill. Those sections would have amended ORS 329.025 and 338.125. The first of those sections, 329.025, deals with public elementary and secondary schools. And in subsection 1 of that section, it talks about students and their educational opportunities not being, they get, they're provided equal access to those things regardless of the various protected characteristics. Sexual orientation was out of there. This section now has been removed. Section 28 of the bill, amending ORS section 338.125, was a similar section dealing with public charter schools and student admission. That section has been removed.
So current law would remain, and that is a public charter school, let's say the Emerson School in Northwest Portland, could deny admission to someone because they are gay.
That's correct.
Okay.
The next amendment is on page 19 of the bill, lines 8 through 45 have been deleted, and then also on page 20, lines 1 through 43 have been deleted. That removes section 32 from the bill. Section 32 would have amended ORS 458.505. That section deals with community action boards. And if you would look over on page 20 of the bill in subsection 4H of that section of law, there was a requirement that a community action agency shall provide assurances that a person may not be discriminated against on various bases and or excluded from participation in various programs and activities. That section has been removed from the bill. The next amendments are on page 22. This is an amendment in Section 34 of the bill, an amendment to ORS Section 659.850. That section deals with discrimination in educational institutions. In subsection 2, if you look on page 22 at lines 6 through 10, it says that a person may not be subjected to discrimination in any public elementary, secondary, or community college education program, service school, or inter-school activity, or in any higher education program or service school or inter-school activity where that program school activity gets money from the state. So at the end of the period on line 10, there's some new language added. It says that, however, this subsection does not apply to prohibit discrimination based on a person's sexual orientation in a public elementary or secondary program or service, school, or inter-school activity. The effect of that is to take away the prohibition on discrimination based on sexual orientation in elementary and secondary schools. The next amendments are on page 20.
Senator Ferrielli.
Those are public elementary or secondary schools?
That is correct.
The next amendments are on page 23. The amendments on lines 34, 35, 36, and 37, well, no, excuse me, 34, 35, and 36 reflect some of the sections of the bill that have been removed, so those references to ORS sections have been stricken, and likewise the section references to the bill have been stricken from that list. In section 40, and then likewise in section 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, and 46, the language talking about that these sections apply to acts committed on or after the effective date of this act, all that language talking about the effective date of the act has been changed to read the operative date of those amendments, because the next section of the bill, a new section 46A, which you'll find on page 3 of the amendments, beginning at line 21, show that all the sections of this bill that deal with discrimination, so everything in the bill that's not involving the civil union parts, become operative on July 1st, 2006. So the bill will take effect on the 91st day following session, so probably sometime in October, but these provisions, these anti-discrimination provisions, will not become operative until July 1st, 2006. So those amendments on those lines on page 23 just reflect that change from effective date to operative date. Are there any questions about that?
Questions?
The next amendments are on page 26. Now we're in the part of the bill dealing with civil unions. And in section 57 of the bill on page 26, amending ORS 106.120, this is the section of law that talks about who can solemnize a marriage. And now under the amendments to the bill, who can also solemnize a civil union. A new subsection 3 has been added, and you'll find that at the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4 of your amendment. It says that no person authorized to solemnize marriages or civil unions under subsection 2 of the section is required to solemnize a marriage or civil union. Subsection 2 says who may solemnize a marriage or civil union. This is simply making it clear that no one is required by the bill or by this section to solemnize a marriage or civil union.
And Mr. McCain, is that your understanding of current law, is that, for example, a religious official is not required to officiate at a marriage that he or she does not believe is appropriate? Is that current law to the best of your knowledge?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And this is just making that explicit, correct?
That's correct. For example, a priest in a Catholic church does not have to marry a Jewish couple,
okay.
And likewise.
Okay.
If you look on page 4 of the amendments, the top half of the page is just a lot of renumbering of subsections because of the addition of that new subsection 3 in ORS 106.120. So the next rule amendments are on page 29 of the bill. And on line 38, which is amending, or excuse me, which is part of section 67 of the bill, it talks about the privileges, immunities, rights, benefits, and responsibilities and the laws of this state, whether derived from, and it currently reads statute, administrative rule, and so on. The purpose of the amendment, you'll see on page 4, at lines 14 and 15, is simply to add a reference to the Constitution. So any benefits that flow, or immunities, privileges, rights, benefits, responsibilities that flow out of the Oregon Constitution are also referenced here.
Questions, anyone?
Madam Chair, the overall character of the dash two amendments are to remove a number of requirements that were in previously in Senate Bill 1000.
I think it's fair to say that the amendments are a narrowing of the original Senate Bill 1000. I think the intent is to address current concerns that were raised during the public hearings.
There's one more amendment that's substantive on page 29. A new subsection 2 has been added to section 67. And you'll see it there on page 4 of the amendment on lines 18 through 20, saying that a child of a partner in a civil union has the same privileges, immunities, rights, benefits, and responsibilities under the laws of this state as are granted to or imposed upon a child of a spouse joined in a marriage. The balance of the amendments are simply subsection conforming amendments, numbering amendments. Any questions?
All right. Mr. McKean, we understand that you need to get on your way. Any further questions for Mr. McKean? All right. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your extreme hard work over the last 24 hours.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate the question.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1000. Okay. Well, why don't we come back and do the work session on Senate Bill 1000 at 6 o'clock? Ms. Smith, Ms. Roach, need each one of you to select one person to respond, talk about the amendments. Senator Shields?
I was concerned about whether Senator Ringo's committee would be done by 6. I've heard it anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half, and they started at 5, is that correct?
I was not aware of that. So
he has a conference committee.
Okay. Well, we'll come back at 6. If Senator Ringo's not available, we'll keep recessing until we need to, but we would like to get this completed this evening. Thank you. I was not aware of that, Senator Shields. So, okay. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1000. Plan to be back at about 6 o'clock. Let's go back to the rest of our daily scheduled agenda. I have Senate Bill 660 apparently is still in the work group process, and we're not going to hear that this afternoon. So keep working. We look forward to a resolution.
Well, we're ready.
You're ready? Oh, you are ready. Oh, I'm sorry.
There's an amendment.
Okay.
We're getting them drafted, but they'll be ready tomorrow.
Okay. All right. So we're going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 60. We'll set the matter over for tomorrow afternoon's agenda. Close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 660. Mr. DeLashmit, you were here on HJR 25. Put a public hearing on HJR 25. Mr. DeLashmit.
For the record, Brian DeLashmit, representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. It's a good bill. Should pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify? It's your last opportunity on HJR 25. Okay, I'm going to go through the resolutions since we are getting tight. I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 13. Anybody else wishing to testify on HCR 13? Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered.
Is that Senator George territory?
If you say so, ma'am, it is.
We'll assign it to Senator George. If he doesn't want to carry it, I'm sure we can find someone else to do it. All right. Open public work session on HCR 17. The chair would move HCR 17 to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We'll find a carry. I need connection. Close the work session. Open a work session on HJM 7. The chair would move HJM 7 to the Senate floor with a due class recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. We're going to let Senator George carry that as well. I believe it's in his territory. Chair would open a work session on HJR 25. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Who'd like to carry? Okay, somebody volunteer.
HCR 25?
Yes. Sarah Ringo, thanks for volunteering.
You're very welcome, Madam Chair.
It's like my son.
She's tough, isn't she?
I'll carry it, Madam Chair. I'm honored.
Too late. You didn't speak up soon enough. All right. Are you going to 25? Conference committee?
At 5 o'clock, yes.
At 5 o'clock. Okay.
Madam Chair, can we move House Bill 2050?
Sure. No amendments?
Dash sixes.
Okay. Chair would open a work session in House Bill 2050. Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, I move the dash six amendments to House Bill 2050.
Senator Ringo has moved the dash six amendments to House Bill 2050. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, move House Bill 2050 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 2050 as amended with a dash six amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. And Senator Ringo, you will get to carry that one.
Thank you.
All right. 3073. Are you guys ready to go on that one? It's ready to go. I'm going to take a look at 3073 and make sure we address Representative Barnhart's issue. 3090 in work group. 3092. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3092. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3092 prohibits the Department of Consumer and Business Services or a municipality administering and enforcing building inspection programs from requiring that plumbing system plans be reviewed for compliance with plumbing specialty codes. And I understand we have the dash five amendment before us as well.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson, and welcome. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3092? Take it away.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing the Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors of Oregon on House Bill 3092. This is our bill. We introduced this bill on plumbing plan reviews because the industry was frustrated at a plan review process that, in our estimation, cost too much, took too much time to do, and once they were done, they had very little bearing out in the field, and so it basically wasn't a bang for our buck. We, through the House, we passed the bill to make them optional, and Madam Chair, you suggested a bill in this committee that would embody the components that we could all agree with. And what we could all agree with was that we would establish by rule what constitutes a complex complex structure for purposes of initiating a plan review. Mm-hmm. We have pre-agreed to that rule, and all this bill does in the dash A5 amendments is authorize DCBS to initiate that rule that we have agreed to. We think it will alleviate some of our problems in that simple plumbing plans will not have to be subject to plan review, leaving plan review just to the more complex that we define by rule. And we have pre-agreed to that rule.
Okay. And Mr. Broadfoot, I see, was in charge of this bill. I assume PacWest is okay with the bill.
PMCA supports, as do all the disparate interests that were opposed to us on the House side, including the building officials and the cities.
And I'm getting a number of nods in the room. I'm also hopeful that should we amend this bill with the dash five amendments, that we will get the House support as well and avoid a conference committee. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I have a file here of people from home urging me to vote no on this bill. Every municipality in my district is written in.
Thank you, Chair Brown and Senator Atkins, and I'm sure that that is the unamended version that they are alluding to.
Mr. Marenberg, do you want to come up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Dave Barenberg for League of Oregon Cities. There was substantial opposition from the cities to earlier iterations of this bill. The amendment as drafted is one that we, in communicating with our cities, we haven't heard of any objections from of the amendment that is being put forward, or we hope that the committee will adopt.
Can you bring Mark Long up here?
Sure. Come on up, Mr. Long. Mr. Long, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes, for the record.
Have you heard the same thing about these Dash 5?
Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, yes. The Dash 5 amendments, I've talked to the Oregon Building Officials Association, worked with Dave. Cities and counties, I'm confident that those jurisdictions are on board with this. With Dash 5.
All three of you look at my bill file. I don't study this issue. On the front of it, it says kill with the conversation and the dates I had. And here's all these people that you're telling me are now okay with this bill under the Dash A5. Yeah?
Well, Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, that I mean, there's no question that those government entities were opposed to the bill as it went through the House, and that's why we amended the bill to be in its current state. I can't for the life of me imagine why they would now be opposed, as Mr. Barenberg testified.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'm happy to talk to any of the communities that have raised issues, and if that is necessary or...
Well, see me afterward and bring a pen and paper.
Okay, happy to.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. We really appreciate you working out these issues. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3092? I'm going to close the public hearing on 3092. Open a work session on 3092. Chair, remove the Dash A5 amendments to 3092. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Rigo?
He's excused.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Ferriello. Aye. Chair Brown.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation as move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Rigo? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferriello.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Who would like to carry the bill? All right, you guys. I'll carry it. Good for me to learn a little bit something about plumbing systems. Thank you. We don't have a lot left. All right. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 671. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 671 establishes criteria that the Public Utility Commission must consider in order for people seeking to acquire public utilities, in order for those persons to acquire public utilities.
Okay.
And we also have two amendments, the Dash 8s and the Dash 12s.
All right.
I think the idea is to adopt those together.
Okay. Mr. Barrows, anybody else? You have anybody else that wants to join you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Barrows representing the Oregon Mutual Development Corporation. No, there is no one here from the corporation at our suggestion. No other members of the lobby team will speak. This bill has been heard. The Dash 8 amendments have been heard and heard and heard in the Senate Business Committee. And so it would be, I think, redundant to go through all the details that we did with that committee. Let me just lay a little quick groundwork. the group of individuals that have retained us are people, by and large, who have had many, many years of experience in electric utilities, including the former CEO of PacifiCorp, the former vice president for finance for PacifiCorp, and so forth. These are knowledgeable people. And they were worried about what would happen to PGE post the Texas Pacific discussion. What should then happen? And they came up with this idea of a mutual concept where the ratepayers of PGE would own PGE and manage the affairs of PGE, keep the same people running it, it's a well-run utility, and move forward. The Dash 8 amendments got the old bill, so nobody should even look at 671 because that was a different bill on a different subject, and Senator Metzger very kindly gave us that bill. And so the Dash 8 amendments stripped that bill out and put in the language. And this bill really does only two simple things. Everything that the mutual utility group would like to do can be done now with one exception, and this bill would fix that one exception. They can form a corporation. They have done that. They can go to Enron's board of directors through their management people and talk to them about acquiring PGE. They have done that. Enron's board of directors has made a decision that they are going to probably, their preferred decision, preferred way of dealing with this is to distribute new stock on PGE to their Enron creditors. We don't know who these are, folks are, but we assume most of them are New York banks, New York hedge funds, retirement funds, folks like that. Nothing wrong with those folks, but they can't pronounce Oregon very well. So these individuals thought maybe there's a better way to do this. They can go to Enron today under the Oregon law and talk to them. They can make a deal with Enron to say, look, the train, your train has started out of the station to move toward stock distribution. We'd like you to stop the train for a second and let us talk to you about our proposal. Enron can do that. They could strike a deal. Then the mutual folks have to come back to the Oregon Public Utility Commission and convince them that the deal they have struck with the Enron Board of Directors is in the public interest. They have to pass the net benefits test. Parenthetically, I would say that the city proposal and the state proposal found in Senate Bill 1008 do not have to do that step. They can pay anything they want. The PUC can say that's a good deal. You guys made a good deal, and we support it. And the way you can pay back the bonds you would sell to purchase PGE would be through the issuance of a PUC tariff. They can do that today. What they can't do today is say we will pass an irrevocable tariff. So the PUC would say, okay, we'll let you sell 20-year bonds, 5% interest, whatever the market calls for, but they can't make it irrevocable. And that, if this bill passed, the Dash 8 amendments are adopted, and this bill passes this legislature, they could then, permissive, make a decision to issue an irrevocable tariff, meaning no subsequent PUC could alter it for the life of the bonds. That would save the ratepayers of PGE about $100 million in a year. That's how much the money markets would reward the irrevocability of the tariff versus a non-irrevocable tariff, $100 million a year. I would also say to you that the day this happened, the PUC said, okay, the mutual concept is the one, we're going to approve it and let it go forward. Taxpayers would save substantial amounts of money on day one for two reasons. One, PG would no longer have to pay federal taxes. And number two, they would not have to pay any stockholders. They would pay, if they have dividend, if they have money left over at the end of the year, and they would give it to the ratepayers. estimated right now, a person has a $100 a month PGE bill, they would probably save $11 a month on day one. And when the bonds were paid off, the acquisition bonds would pay off, they would save about another additional $5 a month. So this is real savings. This is the 10% people have talked about. That can happen on day one with the mutual concept. The only other thing that that sections 12, 13, and 14 of the Dash 8 amendments do is they give the PUC the comfort that they have the ability to oversee this new kind of way of having PGE owned. And the Dash 12 amendments are a final thought from the PUC, which accomplish the same thing. And I would tell you, in the case of the Dash 12s, if you look at them, they talk about the original 671. And Dexter and Legislative Council has assured me if you adopt both the 8s and the 12s, he can marry them down there, do his magic, and they would fit together. So the only thing this bill does is allow the PUC to do an irrevocable tariff and give them the for sure comfort they want in order to be able to manage this utility. This is a great way to save the ratepayers a lot of money. Now, it's not the only way, and there are two other proposals. The city proposal, which doesn't require any action by this legislature, and the state proposal, which does require action by this legislature, and the Senate has passed Senate Bill 1008. You will hear from supporters of that proposal right behind me who will say they don't like our bill because it isn't their bill, in effect. And we're saying let's put all the options at the starting line. Let's let the city get to Enron's board. Let the mutual folks get to Enron. And let's let the state get to Enron. And if one of them can convince them to stop the train and not do stock distribution because it's in the interest of Enron's creditors, and I believe any of them would be in the interest of the state of Oregon and its citizens, let's have all the options available. That's all we're asking. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Barrows?
Thank you very much.
The witness sheet. I can probably guess, but Mr. Nelson, Ms. Brandeis, why don't you come on up? I got hand signals. I think I'm okay, guys. Okay.
You still want me to go first? Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. We are joined here today with ICNU, and I think I can speak on in HUB's behalf as well. The three major customer groups are opposed to House Bill 671 with the mutual utility amendments. I would ask if this bill, and it's the same question that we asked TPG, if this bill is so good for customers, then why are all the customer groups opposed to it? And we are opposed, at least AOI, from our point of view, to this legislation for six reasons. The first is that the bill and the concept were developed without any noticeable input from consumer customer groups. Point two, and this will address Mr. Barrows' comment, We do not oppose this legislation because we support Senate Bill 1008. Quite the contrary, AOI has been neutral on all options up to this point, including the City of Portland acquisition. We are very active in that, but we haven't taken a formal position. Senate Bill 1008, it is an option that we are interested in, and I will tell you why we are interested in it. It has a governing structure, which you all can look at and comment on. It has a board structure, which you all can look at and comment on, and a rate-making structure, which you all can look at and comment on. And none of those are available under this legislation. It's a toss-up to see what we get. Third reason, we believe that this bill and the uncertain regulatory structure associated with it will increase rates, not decrease rates. An acquiring entity can potentially use the securitization financing structure created by 671. This is not about the people we enjoy and enjoy working with in the lobby. This legislation can be utilized by any entity, and this could spark interest among buyers for PGE, lending itself to a bidding war. And a bidding war could increase the purchase price for PGE. And an increase in price transfers the wealth from PGE to Enron and its creditors, not to the customers. We believe this will have an adverse impact on rates because there is no limit on the amount of cost that could be recovered through the non-bypassable charge authorized in the bill. Depending on the terms of the acquisition bonds, the cost of refinancing existing debt, and the transaction costs involved in purchasing PGE, Senate Bill 671 could result in higher rates. Furthermore, Senate Bill 671 does not prohibit the recovery of goodwill, and this is the portion of the acquisition price that is in excess of the book value of PGE. And generally, like when you look at a TPG acquisition, that is not allowed. The OPUC has prohibited the recovery of goodwill, but that is not stated in this legislation. Four, you've heard a lot about the PUC regulation of Oregon Mutual. And traditionally, in PUC regulation, the commission provides balance between the captive ratepayers and the shareholders. And that is their traditional role. This role does not exist under this proposal. Suppose the Oregon Mutual Utility Development Company Board decides to pay for a $75,000 contract, for example, an advertising contract. The OPUC, in its normal role, would determine whether this was a prudent or imprudent cost. If the fee were determined to be imprudent, then the shareholders would pay for this. However, in the Oregon Mutual Utility case, the shareholders and the customers are one and the same. So how does the OPUC regulate or disallow this imprudent cost? Five, we have a concern about applicability to current laws. And I think you also heard something about we can debate some of these things in a future rate case or acquisition case at the PUC. And I'd like you to know that is also a very expensive case. AOI had an intervener grant fund in the TPG case, an intervener fund grant that was for $50,000. That comes out of ratepayers' pockets. So we would have to intervene in this case and make little difference because the PUC has said in its last case, in the TPG case, it is not our job to rewrite an application. That's not our job. Our job is to see if it meets the net benefit. So there is a lot of risk in how the governance structure and the rate-making structure would work, and no certainty that the PUC could fix it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. I share in the points that Julie has outlined to you. We've been given the impression with 671 and amendments to 671 that the OPUC would have some kind of regulatory authority over this new mutual company. We really believe that's illusionary. I mean, the OPUC has no experience in regulating a customer-owned utility. As you know, cooperatives, PUDs, and municipalities have their own boards and regulate, have their own governance. We don't have a structure within the PUC to regulate a customer-owned utilities. And I use the word customer-owned somewhat loosely because we're customer-owned so far only from standpoint is that everyone who has a meter is going their bill is going to securitize this financing. I want to talk just briefly about some of the types of practical examples. And again, as Julie has said, you have a PUC is there to regulate between the investors and the customers and to achieve some type of balance. Julie has talked about the case of where, let's just say, a board member is given a $5 million development fee, a board member of the municipal. OPUC, in its traditional regulatory regulatory power would determine that whether this fee was prudent or imprudent. If the fee was found to be imprudent, the shareholders of the IOU would be responsible for the fee in the normal case of business. And the customers would not see the cost of that fee in their cost. But in this case, the shareholders and the customers are one and the same. They're both customers. So how does the OPUC regulate and disallow this imprudent investment? Second example is rate cases. Same kind of problem. As Julia said, they're very long and they're expensive. But what does the OPUC do if the local board says it needs a raise in rates? If the local board decides that one class of customers should have a lower rate and another rate, again, you have customers and customers. Finally, you have the issue of the development of new electric generating resources. Does OPUC have the authority to tell the elected board that they can or cannot move to other generating facilities? Finally, and I know you're short on time, Madam Chair, again, I want to impress that the financing method is based upon the securitization and putting the cost of whatever the cost of this utility and its purchase onto every single customer. The thought of having reduced rates, we don't even know whether these are going to be tax exempt. We don't believe that they will be tax exempt. Finally, industrial customers, Northwest Utilities, are not supporting the City of Portland. We're not opposing it. We worked on 1008 to make it a better bill, and we think we brought you that. We're not supporting or opposing that particular bill. We believe that it is a bill that will provide the type of governance and the type of process that will work. We want options, too, and that's why we accept the stock distribution. We would accept 1008. We would accept the City of Portland. But this particular proposal is opposed by all customer groups, and that should say something about the proposal.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Sir Atkinson.
What kind of governance structure would make you just support something like this?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, if this was a proposal to set up a co-op and to have an elected board, if something was set up, as you know, the City of Portland is going to be municipal, and of course 1008 is a regional. This bill is silent on that, and how do you mix the OPUC authority and processes which are designed for customers versus shareholders for a customer-owned utility? It just doesn't fit.
Sir Atkinson. So the industrial customers of Oregon are more comfortable with the municipality, like the City of Portland, owning PGE than they are with something like this.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, as you know, INCU it works in both Washington and Oregon. As I've said to many of you, we deal every day with very good public power agencies and very bad public power. And we deal with good IOUs and bad IOUs. We don't have a public versus private preference because we find quality and quite honestly problems on both sides. If everyone has their theory about municipally owned utilities, we work very well with those. You can have a concern about particulars with the City of Portland, but that's really kind of, we're not looking at it that way. We're looking at the fundamental function of how a municipal works or a publicly owned utility works versus an IOU.
Sorry, Mr. Nelson, I was not laughing at you. I was laughing
Sorry.
At my colleague here.
Happened before.
Likewise.
Yes, she was. She was laughing.
Other questions, Sarah Atkinson?
Just one more.
Sarah Atkinson.
What could make, under the concept of a mutual, because I've been kind of leery of the concept of this, but what would, if this were more closely associated with the co-op and the governance structure of a co-op was written in the piece? I have
I can see where you're coming from, but I also know that the PUC is going to react violently. Maybe not violently, that's the wrong word, but the PUC, there's no lack of creative regulatory powers that this body or the PUC can think up overnight. So I don't think we're any lack for laws or regulations around here. But what in your mind, if this were to be a co-op or be more similar to a co-op, would make the industrial customers more comfortable?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, it is the governance structure, the rate structure, that is an elected board. The customers really, truly do own it, whether it's a co-op or a municipality, the city then owns it. But let's stick to the co-op because I think that is more similar to what we have here. And it has a rate-making process that is adopted by the board. It has a governance process. These are things that the board controls, and the customers deal with the elected board members.
So you really believe that the PUC will, if this became a law and a mutual were able to purchase PGE, that PGE would just run under this mutual, would just run wild, and the PUC would no longer have authority in rate making, no longer have authority in governance?
I'm Chair Senator Atkinson. That's part of our problem with this, is the bill is really silent to that. I mean, you could have one situation where, in effect, the PUC is running the utility. If you take what the proponents say and that the PUC can regulate this authority, well, now we have customer versus customer. And so, in effect, the PUC becomes the master of the utility because you're not balancing anything. The board wants to raise rates, and the OPUC says no, or if they say, who controls? You have an elected board, and you have a PUC. That's what doesn't fit within the structure of the OPUC.
Madam Chair, may I just add a couple points to that? I think first and foremost, the PUC is not in the business of regulating consumer-owned utilities. That is not their job. They're in the business of balancing shareholders' interests against captive ratepayers' interests. I think the second point to keep in mind is no matter who would utilize securitization, whether it's Oregon Mutual or some other entity, the PUC has said in its most recent and most important rate acquisition case, the TPG case, it's not our job to rewrite the acquisition proposal. That's not our job. So whoever would utilize the securitization tool could make up anything. In the TPG case, I think AOI had like 99 conditions before that we wanted, and that's random. I think it's 90 or 100. But we wanted approved. And what finally, and I think it was best articulated by Commissioner Baum, he said, we can't rewrite this to meet all these conditions. So again, that's not the PUC's job to create the governance structure.
Sarah Atkinson, any further questions? Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 671. Mr. Hughes, how long is your testimony?
Very brief.
Okay. I hear this noise, and I think it's Senator Farioli's stomach growling, asking for dinner before we move forward. So why don't you come on up? I'm going to open the public hearing. Mine's growling, too, so... On Senate Bill 1079, Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. With me today is Mr. J.C. Reeves, J.C. Reeves Construction Company, who I'm here representing today. He's got all the facts, so he's been at this since day one. Senate Bill 1079, as you see, is a very short bill. It requires... It has a very limited application, and it deals with one piece of property, period, in the state of Oregon, and so far as we can tell. It deals with a 155-acre piece of land in West Salem that's owned by Mr. Reeves. Mr. Reeves has taken the trouble to visit with the mayor of Salem, the city councilman that represents that area, the city planner, the city attorney, they all agree with this Senate Bill 1079. We have visited with the League of Oregon Cities. We've gone to the city of Eugene, the city of Portland, and gave this hypothesis to them about being inside the city limits but outside the UGB. And they all said no. They argued with us that something like this could not happen. And they said it had never happened in their cities, and it never will. So we basically have their endorsement also. They do not care about this bill, it's my understanding. We didn't think it's such a simple, unusual situation that we thought there would be absolutely... My naivety thought that there would be absolutely no one objecting to this, because we're righting a wrong here very easily and very simply. But I'm in receipt of a letter from South and Friends of Oregon, and I see they've testified. And their letter is kind of generally opposed to meddling with the land use plan anyway.
Is that letter from where?
It's from the Thousand Friends, and we just got it before the committee started. It was addressed to Senator Deckert. Okay. And so I suspect the Thousand Friend representative is going to do this, but I'd like to point out one of the paragraphs. It says, we're aware of the fact pattern in Salem that meets the conditions outlined in the bill. It's possible that the land in the city of Portland, but outside the regional urban growth boundaries, would also qualify. Well, we went to the city of Portland, and that's not true. And we're unaware of specific instances or proposals, however. I'm not certain whether Eugene, he says. The third city that meets this definition would be, well, we've already covered that base also. The city of Eugene doesn't have anything like this. So this is a specific bill creating a problem that shouldn't be. And Mr. Reeves can give you a little bit of history on how this happened and why it happened. With your permission, Mr.
Chairman. All right. Mr. Reeves, take it away.
Thank you. This is some property that was initially brought in the 1970s into the urban growth boundary. It was subsequently challenged by Thousand Friends for the boundary being too large. It, in the meantime, in the middle of that, the property got annexed into the city and became into the city and was part of the concept that it had roads and sewers and everything stubbed right to it. So it was all ready to go. Then there was a challenge. Thousand Friends won. Property had to come out.
The urban growth boundary.
The people that were in charge at the time in the city of Salem decided to take this property out.
Of the city. Okay.
They had to take something, I can't remember how many acres, 1,200 acres out or something, of which this 155 was taken out. And that's what happened. That's the whole way this ended up being inside the city but outside the UGB.
And Mr. Reese, have you owned the property for how long?
Eight years. In 8 years, I've been struggling with the process where the whole issue here is there is a managed UBG agreement between city or Salem, Kaiser, Polk, and Marion County that requires an initiator or a leader, so to speak, to initiate a UGB amendment. And none of them want to do it because it is very expensive, it is very time-consuming, and they just have had other issues that are taking their time up, and they have not wanted to take it on.
All right, questions? Senator Shields, did you have a question?
I was a little confused at the way you constructed that rather long sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think you said that it was taken into the UGB, and then it became part of the city. Then there was a challenge by Thousand Friends, and then it was taken out of the UGB, but it also said it was taken out of the city. I didn't think you...
Oh, I'm sorry. That means, no, it was not taken out of the city. It was taken out of the UGB,
okay.
Leaving it in the city outside the UGB.
Right.
Therefore, yeah.
That's,
thank you.
That's, I knew what you meant, but I didn't think you said...
Right.
You said
sorry.
All right. Questions for Mr. Reeves? Mr. Reese, I'm just going to be very upfront with you. I know you've been working on this problem for a couple of sessions, I think. We have folks from 1,000 Friends and the Oregon Chapter American Planning Association signed up against the bill, and Mr. Rindy from DLCD is going to express concern about the bill. But the biggest hurdle you have right now is the big guy in the middle. Has expressed concern about us moving forward on this bill. So I'm not going to take any testimony from these folks this evening, but I would really encourage you. I know your representative, my recollection is Mark Hass is your representative.
Yes.
I would encourage you to meet with your representative, work with Mr. Hughes, probably going to have to try and address some of their concerns, but most importantly, try and get a hold of someone in the governor's office to see if you can't work something out that can be mutually beneficial, that would enable your bill to move forward through the process. But the big guy in the middle is sending some signals here. So I'd encourage you, Mr. Hughes can help you there, and I'd encourage you to kind of start talking with people, and I would encourage you to do it soon because hopefully time is running out. Mr. Hughes?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We will do exactly that. I know he's a reasonable man, and he'll love it when he understands it.
He is. So, thank you very much. Mr. Kafouri, Mr. Rindy, Mr. Hassan, do you just want to come up and put your concerns briefly on the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stephen Kafouri is my name. I'm representing the Oregon Chapter of the American Planning Association. I understand the situation that's happened here. I just want to let you know that I am involved in a somewhat similar circumstance in Washington County, where I'm representing some landowners who want to come into the UGB. Every single situation of people wanting their land to come into the UGB is unique. Every one of them is sympathetic. Every one of them you could make a case for. We have a process for doing that. We don't come to the legislature and ask the legislature to do it. We have citizen planning commissions. We have planning staff. We have processes to go through in the case of Salem. We have other counties and other cities that are involved. And to come to the legislature and ask the legislature to spot zone one particular situation we think is not right. The person who bought this land bought it knowing what the situation was, and to come and ask you to validate his investment is not a good idea.
Thank you. Mr. Rindy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I need to be clear that we are not opposing this bill. We have indicated some concerns, first of all, with just the drafting, but second of all, with the precedent that may be established by having the legislature usurp the local process under which generally citizens in an area, and in this case four local governments, would have an opportunity to evaluate this particular proposal against others. And that's it in a nutshell. I have turned in a letter from Director Shetterly detailing those concerns. I will point out there are other situations where annexed land is currently inside an urban growth inside a city limits but outside an urban growth boundary. The proponent mentioned Eugene. There was a 1980 court case where involving land in the city of Eugene but outside the urban growth boundary. The city of Tangent has a couple hundred, maybe 300 acres of land, farmland, inside the city limits, outside the boundary. And there were other cases at acknowledgement. I have not been able to find out whether any of those have subsequently come into the UGB.
Thank you. Mr. Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan, lobbyist for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'll be brief. I submitted written testimony of Mary Call McCurdy. And just to clarify, the letter that Mr. Hughes referenced was a letter to Senator Deckert. It was written by Bob Stace. He'd be happy to provide that to the committee. The main thing on that letter was we were trying to discover who was interested in the legislation, and we thought it might be having something to do with Portland, which is why Portland's referenced in that letter. I'd echo the sentiments of Mr. Kafouri. That we don't think the legislature is the right place to do this kind of spot zoning, but everything I would say is in the letter before you. So unless you have any questions, that's all I have.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may just add one thing. In terms of timing, I talked today to the planning staff at the City of Salem, and they said that they have no position because they have not had time at this point to talk to their city council and find out where they are.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions?
I close the public hearing on 1079. Mr. Reeves, good luck. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 671.
8. Madam Chairman, I would move the dash. Well,
8.
Madam Chairman, if you wanted to do that. I would move the dash 8 amendments. And Madam Chairman will follow that up with another motion.
Okay. All right. Senator Farrielly would move the dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 671. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash 12 amendments to Senate Bill 671.
Senator Farrielly has moved the dash 12 amendments to Senate Bill 671. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Senator Farrielly.
I would move Senate Bill 671 to the floor. The Dupont's recommendation is amended, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farrielly has moved Senate Bill 671 to the Senate floor with, as amended, with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. I'm going to ask Senator Metzger to carry this bill. So we'll move forward. See if the vote's there on the floor. With that, we're going to be in recess until 6 o'clock. So time to get a little something for your tumblies. Bill 1000. We earlier heard Mr. McKean do a walkthrough of the amendments. Crow, you want to pick one person to come on up? Opposed, want to pick one person to come on up? I don't know if I need to time you. If you just agree that we'll keep it
even.
Go ahead.
Breathe.
Go on right now. We're stuck. Come on, do it.
Only if you served him.
No.
We just did.
Quiznos, you missed it.
No.
Almonds. I didn't get Quiznos. There's dinner. I served it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. Speaking on behalf of the proponents of Senate Bill 1000, there are some of the provisions of the Dash 2 amendments are quite painful for us, but assuming the committee adopts these amendments, we will still strongly support the passage of Senate Bill 1000. I wanted to put a couple of things on the record. The first is that we had suggested some amendments to the civil unions portion of the bill, which legislative counsel was convinced were unnecessary, and therefore Mr. McKean did not include them in the Dash 2 amendments. And I just wanted to describe that we would have added to Section 67 in subsections 2, 4, 5, and 6 language to make it clear that nothing in those subsections would provide access to civil union couples to the institution of marriage itself. Access to the institution of marriage itself, of course, is prohibited by ballot measure 36, which is approved by the voters last fall. But we thought it would be helpful. We thought it would be helpful just to state that explicitly in the civil union statute. But as I mentioned, legislative counsel felt that was would be an unnecessary redundance. So I just wanted to put on the record that. That it is the interpretation of legislative counsel and the ACLU that creating civil unions would still not grant access to the institution of marriage itself for the partners in civil unions. And I think there are two other provisions of the amendments that I'd like to address. The first is the religious exception. And the intent here is to you know, as legislative counsel pointed out, current law already provided, although not really in the right place in the statutes, that churches and other religious institutions could discriminate in employment on the basis of religion in employment positions that were related to the core mission of the religious institution, assuming that, that discrimination based on religion was required by the tenants of the religious institution. We are adding, so that language has been moved to the employment discrimination statute, where it should have been to begin with, and we're also adding language in these amendments that will permit discrimination by a religious institution on the basis of sexual orientation, but only in positions that are related to the core mission of a religious institution. Just for your benefit, I was party to a conversation that Mr. McKean had as soon as he left this hearing with Mr. Castagna of the Oregon Catholic Conference, and they had a back and forth as to the kinds of positions where this exemption would apply and where it would not. And the examples that were given by Mr. McKean were that in a religious school, for example, a religious institution might be able to bar employment to a person based on their sexual orientation, but in a thrift shop run by the same religious institution, they would not be able to discriminate based on sexual orientation under the language of this exception. So again, the idea is to permit a religious institution to discriminate in positions such as clergy positions and other positions that are core to the primary purposes of the church or institution that are not connected to a commercial or business activity that has no necessary relationship to the church or institution or to its primary purpose. And
Mr. Bernanke, yes. Not to complicate this any further, but just trying to get clarification. So, for example, I just put another example on the table. The custodian of the Episcopal Church, they're hiring out the position. The Episcopal Church could not decide to discriminate in that position based on sexual orientation because cleaning the church is not related to the core mission of the institution?
There are two pieces, Madam Chair, to this test.
Okay.
This exception, both of which have to be met. The first is that the employment involved is closely connected with or related to the primary purposes of the church or institution. So I believe in the example you've given, the custodial position is not closely connected with or related to the primary purposes of the church or institution. So the institution would not be able to discriminate in that position. But a teacher or a member of the clergy would be a position that was closely connected to the purposes of the institution. The other provision I wanted to talk about briefly is the provision related to discrimination in education, which appears on page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments. And this provision amends ORS 659.850, which was discussed by Mr. McKean in the earlier work session. It appears on begins on it's section 34 of the original bill that begins on the bottom of page 21 and continues on to page 22 of the original Senate Bill 1000. This statute is written in terms of discrimination against a person involved in public education programs or services. Generally, this, you know, we have always read this statute as prohibiting discrimination against students in public elementary, secondary, community college, and higher ed institutions. All of the cases that I'm aware of deal with discrimination, alleged discrimination against students. The language of the statute is not specific to students. It talks about persons in programs or services. We think that equals students. But I would suggest to you that the amendment would have been a little bit clearer if at the bottom of page 2 of the amendment, instead of making an exception for, this is the language that would create an exception to the prohibition on sexual orientation discrimination in public educational institutions, we would submit to you that it would have been a little bit clearer if it had said on line 30 of page 2 that it does not apply to prohibit discrimination based on a student's sexual orientation in a public elementary or secondary program or service, school or inter-school activity. But we believe that is the effect of the amendment, nevertheless, is that it only covers students. If there were more time, it would have been nice to have cleaned up that particular provision. And if there's a way to do that, I would encourage the committee to do it. Other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Questions for Mr. Fidanke? Sarah Weston, Sarah Shields, Sarah Ferrioli.
We were just talking about, when we saw this the first time, just connecting what's on page 22, sub 2, to the amendment, and I still had trouble pulling those pieces together, maybe because of the rough language or something.
Right. I think...
it's not the most artfully written statute, Madam Chair and Senator Shields.
The stumble, you know, does not apply to prohibit. I mean, that's like a dirt road.
I would agree, Sarah Shields, and I think the chair would be looking towards making a conceptual amendment on line 30 to change person to student. However, your comments about grammar and I don't know if it's syntax are very appropriate given the sentence. So, any other comments, questions? Sarah Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way I read the bill, under the current iteration of the amendment, it would appear to me that a school district, a public school district, could dismiss a teacher who is gay or lesbian under the provisions of this bill simply because of their sexual orientation.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I don't read it that way. Because the employment discrimination statute would specifically prohibit that, and it's been our understanding that this statute only provides protection to students and other participants in a program. If you look at the language of the current law, again, this is page 22 of Senate Bill 1000, the way that the law would be rewritten, even with these amendments, would provide that a person may not be subjected to discrimination in any public elementary, secondary, or college education program or service. So I think you have to be in the program or service, not operating the program or service, to come under the sweep of this statute and its protection.
And, I mean,
Senator Ferrioli.
On the dash two amendments on page 2, line 29, I think that's the section that we're referring to.
Yes.
However, this subsection does not apply to prohibit discrimination based on a person's sexual orientation in a public elementary or secondary program or service, school or inter-school activity. And I think the interpretation of a secondary program or service or school or inter-school activity could be extrapolated to include teaching, because that certainly is a program or service that is found within a public elementary or secondary program.
Madam Chair,
an example of ambiguous drafting, in my opinion.
Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli, which is, I mean, I agree that that is that is a possibility in terms of how this amendment could be interpreted, which is why I think it would be better to say a student's sexual orientation and to eliminate that possible ambiguity. Again, I think in context, the statute currently only provides protection to students and other participants in a program and does not apply to staff members or teachers or faculty, that the employment statutes provide the protection to those individuals. And Madam Chair, there's actually one other point I wanted to make.
Why don't we have Mr. Hendricks come on up and just help
with that. The additional point I wanted to make is that under the Tanner decision, Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution prohibits sexual orientation discrimination against any individual by a state or local government agency, including school districts.
That is employed.
That is employed, correct. But it also, you know, more broadly prohibits sexual orientation discrimination by the government. There is some doubt about how the Oregon Supreme Court would deal with the issues that were dealt with in Tanner, because the court has never been faced directly with those issues, which is why we would like to spell these things out in statute more explicitly with regard to public institutions. But there would be that protection, at least theoretically, for students in public educational institutions and certainly for employees.
Okay. Further questions, Senator Farioli?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Hendricks, can you help us out here?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. This statute here in Chapter 659, the way I have always read it, I always thought it was applying not necessarily just to students, but certainly not to be something that would override what's in Chapter 659A, where you have the set of laws that we normally think of the laws relating to discrimination. And there are three categories in there. There are laws that prohibit discrimination based on employment. There are laws that prohibit discrimination based on housing. And there are laws that prohibit discrimination in providing public accommodations, things like the barber shop, the cafe, the hotel. You look at this, and where you're looking at the language of this particular amendment, you're saying that this subsection does not apply to prohibit discrimination based on the person's sexual. It is only making a statement about what this particular subsection of this law. I would not see that in any way of overriding what 659 says about discrimination in employment, public accommodations, etc., where you're talking about, for instance, a teacher employment.
And the follow-up?
Mr. Senator Farioli.
Then what protection does this have?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I think the intent of this statute when it was enacted was probably to make it very clear that schools could not discriminate against students in providing services to them. That's a little different than a public accommodation under 659. These are governmental services. Frankly, I doubt if they could have anyway, but it's one of those laws that I'm sure everybody thought, you know, was a good idea. You don't want to have schools discriminating against students based on race, sex, national origin.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
So I do not read the word students in that sentence. No.
That's correct, Senator Farioli. The statute currently says persons. I think if you read the statute as it's written right now, it is unclear. I think it's fairly clear in terms of the application of the law that it has been used to protect students' rights. If teachers are concerned about employment discrimination, they go to a different chapter and different section in ORS Chapter 659.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think we're also discussing, I think, an amendment to that particular sentence. Changing the word person to student gives it very clear meaning.
Madam Chair, before Mr. Hendricks leaves, there might be one other word that might need to be changed.
Okay.
Which is in the civil union section, and this was one that we had suggested to your staff, but I'm not sure that that suggestion made it as far as legislative council, and it's on page 30 of the bill in section 67, subsection 3. And again, this goes back to this issue of whether we want to be sure that no one could read the civil union section 30. To be attempting to provide the actual right of marriage to the partners in a civil union. We'd suggested changing the word same at the end of line 3 on page 30 to comparable, so that that subsection would read, this section shall be construed to secure for partners in a civil union the comparable legal status as that conferred upon spouses in a marriage with the same privileges, rather than the same legal status. Because the use of the word same might imply that it's marriage, and it isn't.
Mr. Hendricks, could you respond to that from a legal perspective? I would assume that the passage of ballot measure 36 prohibits us from conferring the same legal status on civil unions as that of marriages. Or is it prohibiting same-sex partners from marrying?
Chair Brown, that's a tough one for ballot measure 36, because it kind of goes to the heart of what the voters were trying to accomplish with that measure. Clearly, it said that we do not want to have the marriage in the sense that at least marriage is the term is used in the statutes now, at the very term. I think. Whether or not you could, certainly you could not amend the statutes to simply add same-sex couples to the marriage statutes. I mean, that obviously would be prohibited. Whether or not, how far you down the line you can go to creating an equivalent status like the civil union wants without, you know, I'm afraid it may just come down to terminology. I've always wondered on 36, marriage versus civil unions, because there was so much discussion before the passage of the ballot measure, including by proponents saying, some of the proponents indicating that they were not opposed to civil unions. Raising the questions was what the difference between a civil union that conveys all the same status but not isn't called a marriage. And so there was a lot of questions about, seems to me, about what people thought they were buying with ballot measure 36, other than it was clear we don't want to have marriage, the term attached to it.
Madam Chair, if I could just address that. I think the issue we're trying to get at here, that we were trying to get at by substituting the word comparable, is that there's nothing, civil unions would not be marriage. They would not be the same. They would not be treated the same way in public perception as marriage. Marriage has a very clear, it means something very clear to the public at large. It means something very clear in the law. There's nothing in Senate Bill 1000 that would change marriage. And we just thought it would be a helpful clarification to make it explicit in this subsection that you're not conferring the same legal status, because it wouldn't be the same status. It would be comparable in that the benefits, that the privileges, immunities, rights, benefits, and responsibilities that married couples enjoy under state law would be provided comparably through civil unions. But it wouldn't be the same as marriage. It could never be the same as marriage, because by definition it's different.
So, Chair Westland.
So the question, David, is there a legal reason not to take out same and insert comparable?
Chair Brown, Senator Westland, I think that there might be a legal reason for taking it out. I mean, the argument being made here is that there might be some danger under ballot measure 36, that if you say it conveys the same legal status, that perhaps ballot measure 36 would not allow that.
I agree.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Appreciate your indulgence.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. We'd love it if you'd stick around. Your information has been very helpful. Ms. Smith, Mr. Castagna, I'm in a good mood. Why don't you come on up? Talk to us about the religious exemption.
Let him go on that. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your indulgence. For the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. The conversation that I had with Mr. McEwen focused on the amendments on page 2, particularly on line 6, related to the primary purposes of the church or institution. And I asked Mr. McEwen, what does that mean? And he gave the example of a priest. The church would be free to hire its own clergy. And then I asked the question, teacher. And he said, yes, that would be considered a primary purpose of the church. He then suggested, however, that in a janitor, you couldn't discriminate. And that's where we would take exception to this legislation, because we think the language runs the constitutional risk of excessive state entanglement in the affairs of a religious organization. That the church, that the state would be defining through interpretation the primary purposes of the church or institution. Our employees sign contracts that have a lifestyle clause in them, and if the lifestyle becomes an issue of public scandal, the church reserves the right to terminate that employment. If the janitor, in the example that Mr. McEwen offered, were to be active in the community in a way in which it would offend church morals, the church should be able to dismiss that employee. And that's problematic, because then you have an excessive entanglement of the state trying to define the primary purposes of the church. And I would say that's unconstitutional.
Thank you, Mr. Castagna. Questions? And, Mr. Castagna, back to your issue of morality. Run that through me again, please.
On the lifestyle issue.
Yes.
In the contract, the church reserves the right, if someone is leading a lifestyle contrary to church teaching, to be able to dismiss that employee.
Under current law?
Correct.
Okay. So if you, Mr. Fidanke?
Madam Chair, under current law, the state prohibits discrimination based on marital status of an employee. There is currently no exception for a religious institution to that prohibition on discrimination.
For example, if the church doctrine prohibited divorces and a woman that worked for the church as a secretary got a divorce, under current law, even though the church was opposed to her morality, the church could not fire her because of her marital status. Is that correct, Mr. Fidanke?
That is correct under current law. Now, I'm assuming the church would argue they might have a constitutional free exercise basis to prevent enforcement of that provision of the statute. But the current law prohibits a church from refusing to hire or firing someone for that reason. Another example would be
related to the core mission
that,
of the church.
No, under current law, even if the job is related to the core mission of the church, the only basis on which a religious institution can engage in discrimination is the religious affiliation of that employee.
Mr. Castagna, response?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess we would take exception to that in terms of the excessive entanglement issue and whether or not the church could prohibit a parish or a school from terminating an employee based upon a lifestyle issue.
Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Castagna, what you're saying is that you believe the Catholic Church can fire someone from its employment based on a person's, what you would consider, immoral behavior.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, based upon the contract that the Archdiocese has with its employees and the lifestyle provision within that contract, the Archdiocese remains the right to terminate its employees if they violate that lifestyle clause.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Fedanke, the dash two amendments would appear to create that right for the church.
Correct.
So that right currently does not exist in Oregon law.
That is correct.
This amendment would create that right for the church.
That is correct.
And you hold that this amendment would be unconstitutional based on...
No, I believe this amendment is constitutional. What I was trying to point out to the committee was that current law, the only exception under current law for religious institutions is for discrimination based on religion. That is the only exception under current Oregon anti-discrimination statutes that gives greater latitude to religious institutions to engage in discrimination than other institutions have in employment. And so what we are trying to do is carve out an exception for that would permit sexual orientation discrimination in certain situations, but other types of discrimination which are already prohibited under current Oregon law have no religious exception except for the provision relating to discrimination based on religion.
So this would, Madam Chair, create a greater latitude for discrimination?
By religious institutions. Yes, it would.
Based on sexual orientation.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wessler.
Bob, we've got a difference of opinion here, obviously. Has there ever been a test case, I mean, with a clear fact circumstance where an employee was fired from the Catholic Church, you know, on moral grounds, clearly violating deep held beliefs of the church? They were fired. That employee said, no, no, you can't do that, and litigated the issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, I don't know the answer to that question. All I do know is that the lifestyle issue is a part of the contracts for school employees, and this is not unique to the Archdiocese of Portland or to the state of Oregon.
Right.
For your school employees?
Right.
My reading of this bill would not prohibit you from discriminating against people teaching in your churches, prohibiting the hiring of a gay or lesbian person. You must agree with that reading.
Madam Chair, my concern was the interpretation offered to me by legislative counsel when he went into the situation of the janitor. If the janitor is working for a school exclusively and signs a contract, that lifestyle provision is going to be there. And if that person were to engage in conduct that caused a scandal in the parish or the school, the church would retain the right to terminate that employee.
But you would agree that under the language of the bill, you can continue to discriminate in hiring practices for teachers in your schools. You can continue to discriminate against gays or lesbians should you choose to do so.
Madam Chair, under the language of the bill, provided that the employment is related to, however the courts interpret, primary purposes of the church or institution, the church retains the discretion to hire and fire. My question is, who is going to interpret primary purposes of the church or institution, and whether or not it's going to come down to a court decision, and whether or not the janitor, if he's working for the school exclusively, is deemed to be part of that primary purpose if the janitor is living a lifestyle which causes scandal to the community. That's my question.
And you don't think there is any case law existing in the United States today on the primary purpose?
There may very well be, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Farrelly.
Again to Mr. Fedanke. We routinely have instances where citizens waive their constitutionally guaranteed rights. For instance, I'm most familiar with the Fifth Amendment. I guess I'd like to ask you if the existence of a contract and a condition of employment conditions that exercise of the constitutional rights.
Madam Chair and Senator Farrelly, without reviewing the remainder of Chapter 659A related to employment, I can't remember if it is an unlawful employment practice for an employer to require a prospective employee to waive statutory rights as a condition of employment. But I think that would answer your question. However, and I just, I'm sorry, I can't recall. But there was one other thing that occurred to me as Mr. Castagna was speaking, which is that he talked about a public scandal. I think the statute goes to prohibiting discrimination against a person because of their sexual orientation, not because of some other activity that they have engaged in that may be tangentially related to their sexual orientation. For example, you know, if you have a teacher who has an affair with a minor, a sexual relationship with a minor, I think that would be cause for termination, regardless of what the gender of the minor is. And that would not be a termination based on the sexual orientation, but it would be based on the conduct of the employee that was contrary to the policies of the institution. And in that case, contrary to law.
Right. Madam Chair, I don't want to go that much further into the thicket of employment agreements other than to say, in the private sector, there are, in fact, performance clauses that are routinely used. CEOs regularly submit to those kinds of, particularly high-profile CEOs submit themselves as a condition of employment to a performance and performance standards clauses, and they're routinely, regularly terminated for violating those clauses. Those are not based on sexual orientation.
I don't think anybody...
They can be based on sexual conduct. Or misconduct.
Senator Ferriello, I don't think anything in this statute, in this proposal, would prohibit those types of agreements.
And Chairman, I don't disagree. What I'm suggesting is that they, according to Mr. Pedanke, are for the first time creating those. Now, that's not in accord with the...
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, the Catholic Church in its teaching distinguishes between sexual orientation and sexual activity. One of the failings of this measure that it does not make that distinction.
Okay. Ms. Smith. Thank you. And I'm Judy Smith with the Oregon Family Council. Just as a reminder, we're non-affiliated, so therefore I thank you for allowing Bob Castagna, because I do not feel qualified to comment on the religious exemptions in this bill, because I do think that's to be left for somebody more qualified than myself. You know, we appreciate the spirit of these amendments, and I think that the committee and you particularly, Senator Brandt, have gone a long way in satisfying a lot of the testimony that was offered up. It's always been the position of Oregon Family Council as the civil union part of the bill. We still feel, however, that regarding these amendments, that it's in a violation of Measure 36, because we feel that every Oregon marriage statute can be affected by the language in this bill. When Oregonians voted for the passage of Measure 36, it was very clear that marriage is reserved for between one man and one woman. We do not feel that these amendments have satisfied anything in getting us to go along with supporting Senate Bill 1000 with these amendments. Something else that we feel that's been totally ignored in this bill and in Senate Bill 1073 is the fiscal and economic impact that has been ignored. I think the fiscal impact that came back on Senate Bill 1073 was indeterminate. I don't think that a proper time and allowances for considerations of what this is going to cost government and what this could cost our business community as far as offering benefits, particularly health benefits, to a different group. We have not heard from insurance companies on this, what the rates could possibly be for employers or what financial impact that would have on the rates. And this is at a time in Oregon when we know that health benefits are rising and it's becoming out of reach for costs for a lot of Oregonians, regardless of any other special provisions we might allow for somebody. We also disagree in that we don't feel that sexual orientation is a litmus test for certain rights. I think that this has been dealt with very emotionally. I think there's been a lot of thought and consideration into these amendments, but there are still some practical concerns we have. We still support reciprocal benefits, and for many reasons. Because of the fiscal impact, there is negligible. Yes, those benefits don't satisfy everybody, and we know that that bill isn't perfect, but we feel that is a very good start for this session, to pass something along those lines to allow benefits to this particular class of citizens who I have always stated we feel are worthy of benefits. However, we do not feel that we want to impose on Measure 36 in the spirit that Oregonians pass that measure, and also in these tough economic times, as you all know, trying to agree on budget realities, that there is fiscally the state of Oregon at this particular time can afford to administer this bill. So I'll just keep it short and sweet, and I'm open to questions if I can answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Not questions for Ms. Smith.
Well, I just want to say I really appreciate, and Oregon Family Council has appreciated everything that you've done in this bill. And I do think that we can work toward an agreement eventually on this.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Smith, I had a member approach me today about the reciprocal beneficiaries issue. If we only have a couple weeks left in session, it's probably not appropriate to start a new bill, but I'm more than happy to take a look at that issue if you want to get me a list of what benefits you think are appropriate under the reciprocal beneficiaries issue. I'm happy to take a look at that.
Great. We also feel at this late date in the session, kicking this over to the House is talking about possibly adjourning or recessing next week. You know, we think this is going to be problematic, getting it passed over there. But like I say, you know, who knows? Like I say, who knows? But thank you for allowing me to testify, and thank you for your hard work on this.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify on this bill? All right, I'm going to close. We're not in public hearing. Would you get Senator Ringo, please? I believe he's
sure.
Next door.
Next door.
Just for the record, I understand that folks only received the amendments at 4 o'clock. Senator Farrell and I had numerous conversations about that. We made a decision after conferring with Senator Farrell that we move forward tonight rather than waiting till tomorrow morning. It's my understanding that there's going to be a minority report, and we would like to get this to the floor as quickly as possible. Senator Farrelly and myself felt like it was better to move forward this evening. I believe that everyone in the audience has had ample time to review the amendments and provide any input. So that's where we're proceeding tonight.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
For scheduling purposes, you refer to a hearing tomorrow morning. Better than doing it tomorrow morning. Had you anticipated a hearing tomorrow morning Rules Committee?
No. Well, we had anticipated receiving the amendments substantially before 4 o'clock today. Despite Legislative Council's best efforts, we were not able to get them until 4. So, as you know, I make it a practice of making sure my committee members as well as members of the public have an opportunity to review the amendments before we discuss them and vote on them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Westland.
Frank, let me steal your bill. And maybe this is a question for the Daves. On page 22 of the bill,
Yes.
On page 22 of the bill, line 6, section subsection 2, a person, we're talking person.
Correct.
And then we end that by inserting, however, this subsection does not apply to prohibit discrimination based on a student. I believe we're going to amend that to students. Is there a consistency issue there?
Mr. Hendricks?
Based on both case law and the reading of the statutes, that it is not technically necessary to amend person to student, but we wanted to address Senator Farioli's concern that we would allow discrimination based on sexual orientation of teachers in this state. And we wanted to make sure that we clarify that the person in this particular instance is not a teacher, but rather a student in an activity that we would allow the discrimination on. Mr. Hendricks, is that?
Chair Brown, Senator Westland, that's correct. And since this is an exception, to the extent that maybe the statute does cover somebody other than students, the exception at least would only apply to students. So I don't think it's too much of a problem with consistency. You know, the statute applies to persons generally, but the exception here would just simply say that it doesn't act to prohibit discrimination based on a student. So that's a narrower category than what it's covered, but it doesn't create a problem from a drafting standpoint that I see.
Okay. All right, so we are in work session. The chair would ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules in order to consider a conceptual amendment. Any discussion? Any objection? Without objection. Thank you very much. The chair would propose on line 2 of the dash 2 amendment dated 6-23-05, page 2, a line 30, that the word persons, person apostrophe S, be changed to student.
Students
apostrophe S. Okay, I'm going to do that one more time, James, just so we got it. On line 30, page 2 of the dash 2 amendment stated 6-23-05 to Senate Bill 1000, the word person apostrophe S would be changed to student apostrophe S. Any discussion? Any objection?
No objection.
Thank you so much. The chair would move the dash 2 amendment.
Is that the only conceptual amendment
Yes.
you wish to make?
Yes. Yes.
We don't want to compare comparable?
No.
That's just what I was going to suggest, Madam Chair.
I understand that. I'm happy to have a conversation with Senator Westland outside if you wish, and the committee can be at ease for a minute.
No. Okay. Keep going.
I'm just standing up straight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So is the committee
We're at ease.
Chair?
5 minutes. We're back on the record. The chair would move the dash 2 amendments as conceptually amended. Dash 2 amendments. Okay. The chair would move the dash 2 amendments. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
I'm going to. Okay, I will.
Can we move all of the hours and days of testimony from 1073 from the record onto this, since we have limited testimony on it?
On this bill?
Yeah, just for the
record. Sarah Atkinson, this is Senate Bill 1000. We had over 7 hours of testimony on this particular bill.
Can we move the other testimony from all those bills on the public
sure.
record onto this?
We will see if we can do that. That would be very easy to do. That would complete many hours of testimony.
Okay.
I'm happy to do that if we can anyway provide that. Any objection to Senator Atkinson's motion to combine the public testimony on Senate Bill 1073 with the public testimony on Senate Bill 1000? Seeing none? So ordered? We'll make it happen. Okay. The chair would... move to adopt the bill as conceptually amended and as amended by the dash 2 amendments. Any objection?
Madam Chairman, I'll be voting now and serving notice of possible consideration of a minority report.
Okay.
And under the discussion section, I'd like to just to touch on some of the issues.
Okay. Any other no votes?
Yes.
Sarah Atkinson. All right. Senator Farioli, discussion.
Briefly, Madam Chair, because I don't think I can add very much clarity to the hours of testimony that's here, but The concerns that I have is that there's been an honest attempt and a very diligent attempt to try to draft our way out of the thicket in this bill. And I acknowledge the work of the chairman and the work groups that have come together. But I don't believe this bill solves the problem. The way I read the bill, even with the conceptual amendment, there may be some challenges that are brought on a constitutional basis, and certainly I don't think we could prevent that even if we wanted to. The approach that the bill takes, I think, is an attempt to add to the list of protected classes. And every time we try to do something by inclusion, what we end up doing is excluding some other protected group or group that should be. The concern was raised in testimony that this appears to be attempting to repudiate the will of the voters in passing the constitutional amendment that passed. The discussion of same and compared to is one that Senator Westland was sensitive to, and I think with good reason. I think that this is an invitation to constitutional change. I believe that the proponents are supporting this bill in earnest because it is critical to them as people and as citizens of Oregon. And also, I believe, because they don't see another option in this legislature than this vehicle. I don't believe that this vehicle fares well in the House. And so I'm concerned that the effort that has gone into this process will not create or produce the intended outcome of any of the people in this process. Therefore, Madam Chair, in voting no, we are creating the opportunity to offer a minority report, and we intend to try to revisit the whole issue of non-discrimination. And Madam Chair, I'm not certain that we will be any more successful than the drafters of this bill, but it would be our attempt to try to assert Oregonians' obligation not to discriminate against other Oregonians, rather than to add to the list of protected classes or to try to do some artful definition that creates a civil union that for all intents and purposes is marriage by another name. So, Madam Chair, that's a big bite. If we only have a couple of hours to try that, but we're willing to make the attempt to do that.
Just a couple things for the record. The page one of the dash two amendments, the language regarding the religious exemption was designed to track federal case law based on the ministerial exemption, which has been interpreted by every federal circuit court in the country. The fiscal impact you all should have in front of you on Senate Bill 1073. We will have a fiscal impact before us before we vote on this bill. Anything further? Senator Shields?
Since Senator Farioli took several minutes, let me just take 30 seconds to say that I appreciate very much what you did and what all of the proponents of the bill did in this dash two amendments to try to accommodate concerns that you heard. Personally, I feel at some level we maybe gave away too much. Okay? Having said that, I think we have a moral obligation to pass this bill, and I just had to say that, and I just hope we can get on.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Anything else? Please call the roll.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Bates, Senator Westland, Senator Morse, I would really appreciate your help in carrying this bill on the Senate floor. Any further business to come before the committee? All right. We're adjourned till tomorrow afternoon, guys.